All right. This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Dr. James Wilbanks. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Dr. Wilbanks is in Leavenworth, Kansas. It is the 20th of September, the year 2000, at approximately 8:10 Lubbock time. All right, Dr. Wilbanks, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of your early life?
Okay, I was born in Hot Springs, Arkansas, in 1947. My father was a career NCO in the Army, so we moved around quite a lot. Probably spent the longest time in Coppersville, Texas, outside Fort Hood. My junior year of high school, my father was transferred to Germany, and that's where I graduated from high school in Augsburg, Germany, and Bavaria. I departed Germany and went to Texas A&M, where I attended for 4 years and graduated in 1969, receiving commission as a second lieutenant of infantry.
Okay. When you entered Texas A&M and as you were going through the university, getting your degree and your commissioning, how aware were you of what was going on in Southeast Asia? Did you keep up with it closely? You know, what did you think was going on over there, and what did you think the United States was trying to accomplish?
I was very much aware of the fact that we were in the midst of a war because obviously successive classes had gone off, most of them with only about 4 months at places like Fort Bragg and Fort Hood, before being assigned to Vietnam, and unfortunately some of the people I knew were not coming back. In terms of, you know, the great strategic grand design for what the United States was doing in Vietnam, I was probably largely ignorant of that, other than the effort to stop communism. Other than that, I probably didn't have much of a depth of knowledge about what was going on there and what the situation was really like.
Was there much protest activity or anti-war activity going on at Texas A&M while you were there?
Zero.
And that's surprising, right?
Well, the only thing that I remember is that some SDS folks from the University of Texas came over to organize a chapter, and they were met by a large number of myself and my compatriots at the front gate and invited to return back to Austin, which they did. And that was my touch with the anti-war movement, I guess.
The ROTC instructors that you had at Texas A&M, were any of them Vietnam veterans?
All of them.
All of them. Did they talk much about their experiences with you cadets?
It's a kind of a strange situation. There really wasn't any overt, necessarily, talk about Vietnam, but it was just kind of a specter that was hanging there. I mean, you knew that when you graduated, more than likely you were going to spend, you know, go to officer training and then go 4 months to some stateside post and then to Vietnam. I mean, that's what was done then. That was the norm. So it sort of permeated everything we did, but not overtly. I mean, I don't think anybody spent a lot of time worrying about it, but it was certainly always there as a concern.
Okay. And as far as just discussion amongst you cadets, did you, as cadets and as college students, did you talk much about Vietnam?
Not a lot. I don't guess. But like I say, the specter was always there. We knew that we were all going sooner or later, because you know the period 65 to 69 was the height of the war. There wasn't any way you could get around it. It was on the news every night. It was in the newspaper every day. So it was pretty just much there as a fact of life.
Okay. What about some of the highlight portions of the Vietnam War? Let's see. Perhaps very important, of course, was the Tet Offensive 1968. How much did you learn about that and know about that? What was your perception based on what you were hearing in the news and whatnot? You know, what did you think happened in Tet 68?
Like most Americans, I was stunned by the fact that the length and breadth of the and the nature of the attack, after so many positive things were said about progress in Vietnam, that the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong could mount something that large in such a surprise fashion was pretty stunning. And of course, it was on. It permeated the news, the media, and all parts of the media. So it was pretty hard to get away from.
And just out of curiosity, prior to Tet 68, had you been aware of General Westmoreland's visit to the United States? His testimony before Congress, you know, explaining that from his perspective, the war was really close to an end. The proverbial light at the end of the tunnel. Perception that he relayed to Congress and to the American people in, I guess it was November of 67, in early December 67. Were you aware of that, and did that increase your sense of surprise, if you will, that, you know, here we had the commanding general forces over there coming and telling us, well, it should be over pretty soon, and then all of a sudden, bang, Tet 68.
I guess so. That was a long time ago for me to remember. I have to tell you, though, that like most college students, maybe more than those who were involved in the, actively involved in the anti-war movement, my near-term battle was trying to get through college. I didn't have a lot of money. I was working working part-time so I could stay in school. So that was my focus, was try to get through and get a degree and get a commission. I was aware of those other kinds of things, but I got to tell you that my focus in life was surviving the next 24 hours and staying in school.
Okay. Let's see here. What about your major at Texas A&M was history?
Right.
Did you study much Asian history? Or?
No.
Okay.
I think I had one course.
Okay. Let's see. How about in ROTC? Was there much talk about, in particular, of course, Vietnam history in relation to the Vietnam War?
Not a lot about history. More tactics, techniques, and procedures kinds of things. General military history, as I remember, we took the first 2 years. The U.S. Army in the greater context of American history, but not any specific Southeast Asian or Vietnamese history, or even U.S. Army in Vietnam.
Okay. Let's see. Well, okay, so in terms of your understanding of Vietnamese history or even certain aspects of Vietnamese current events, were you familiar with some of the other key events early in the war, things like, of course, the end of the French-Indochina War, Geneva Accords, the Diem government, their refusal in 1956 to hold the elections, those types of issues.
Yeah, I was generally aware of what had gone on before, but like I say, I'd be less than frank if I told you that I was studying it closely, because I certainly wasn't.
Okay. And from your perspective, prior to getting your commission as the son of someone in the United States Army, the son of an NCO, and just out of curiosity, what was your dad's MOS?
Infantry and then armor.
Infantry armor. Okay. So combat arms.
Right.
All the way. What? In terms of the reality on the ground in Vietnam, prior to entering active military service, what did you think was actually going on there? Was it just communism?
I'm a child of the Cold War. To me, it was fairly black and white. It was the good guys against the communists. There were obviously various gradations of that as I've continued to study it over the years. But to a college kid, it was. Who was immersed in the Cold War and someone who had been to the Berlin Wall as a 16-year-old, the Cold War looked pretty real to me, and it looked like a pretty clear-cut case of the Western Bloc against the Communist Bloc. Obviously, it was a lot more complex than that, but at that particular time, I really wasn't aware of all the complexities involved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there anything else that stuck out, that sticks out in your mind from your experiences as a cadet in ROTC at Texas A&M?
In terms of what? Kinds of things stick out.
In terms of, how it affected you later as a military officer, how it might have helped you when you found yourself in rather trying situations in Vietnam.
I think my attendance at Texas A&M and as a member of the Corps defined who I am to this day.
Okay.
That's very hard to describe. You know, Texas A&M is a pretty strange place from the outside looking in. It's pretty difficult for me to describe what it's like from the inside looking out.
Okay. Well, let's see. Well, let's go ahead and talk about going into the United States Army. You know, what did your dad think about you getting your commission?
Oh, I think he was pretty proud.
Yeah.
You know, NCOs at that time didn't make a lot of money. I was the first person from my family to go to college, and by and large, with scholarships and various other things, I paid for it virtually myself, so that's always been a point of pride with me. And I think my father was. My father's a very, let's just say, not outgoing type, and leave it at that.
Okay.
He's not a real demonstrative type in terms of emotions, but I think he was proud.
Okay. How did you feel?
Oh, I felt great. I felt like I had accomplished something, you know. All universities have their trials. A&M seems to have its own kind of unique set of trials, and I felt like I'd passed them all. There was some not concern, but certainly, I mean, Vietnam was basically a specter, and that's probably not a word that I can use. It sort of permeated everything. You knew that you were going to be there sooner or later. In 1969, it looked like there was no end in sight. You knew you were going to be there sooner or later, and there was the idea that you wanted to make sure that you were good enough so you didn't get soldiers killed. So there's always that, at least in the back of my mind.
Okay. What about, or what effect did LBJ's decision in 68, early 68, not to run for election, what kind of effect did that have on you and your, you know, here you are going into the active duty Army, getting more than likely probably going to end up in Vietnam, and here back in 68, the president's kind of quit, commander-in-chief, and of course from Texas.
Well, I have to tell you that and at the near term, our focus was, and I speak for lots of my classmates, that, you know, what was going on at the strategic level didn't have a lot of impact on what was going to happen to a platoon leader as long as we continued to fight. I mean, they could have peace talks in Paris. They could do whatever they wanted to do. But the bottom line is, if you ended up in Bin Long Province with a rifle platoon somewhere, it pretty much looked the same. If I told you I was really concerned about all these strategic national-level issues, I'd be lying. It was just largely assumed that the war was going to continue in some fashion, that we were going to be there sooner or later.
Okay.
Now, I had no sense that the war was going to wind down, be over, you know, a change in administration was going to have any large impact on my life as a platoon leader.
Mm-hmm. What did your dad think about this war?
Interestingly enough, we didn't talk a lot about it. I did not live near my parents. Well, I was when I went to school. I was some distance from my parents. In fact, for the first year, they were still in Europe. Then they were in Arkansas, which means I only got home a couple times a year. It wasn't something we talked a lot about. You know, he doesn't talk a lot about the Korean War. It's just not. He's just not that kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Is that both before and after you went on active duty and into to Vietnam?
Right. Yeah.
You haven't talked. You didn't talk after.
In the last 4 or 5 years, he's begun to talk about his Korean experiences, and I think that's a function of old age.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned more probably in the last 3 years than I have, you know, the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So why don't you describe? First going on active duty, going to Fort Benning, Georgia, to the Infantry Officer Basic Course. Describe that training that you received there, if you will.
Well, I went. I reported to Fort Benning, I think it was 6 days after graduation. And there, Vietnam permeated all the training. Virtually, you know, that was the intro to every class. Listen up, you're going to Vietnam. You either know this stuff or you're going to get killed or get people killed. And all of the instructors had been to Vietnam, most on multiple tours. some fairly couple of strange happenings there. I went to one training. I think it was mortar. I can't remember, to tell you the truth. And there was a captain with 101st Combat Patch, and it was a guy who had been 2 years behind me in high school at Copper's Cove, who apparently had joined the Army right after high school and then went to OCS, and he had had 2 tours in Vietnam by then. So that was kind of a strange occurrence. Left Fort Benning in the late fall of 69 and went home for leave, and then reported to my new unit, which was 2nd and 30th Infantry in Schweinfurt, Germany, 3rd Infantry Division.
Was there anything that, in your training at Fort Benning, how heavy of an emphasis was there on conventional or counterinsurgency warfare?
Well, the emphasis was on what we call counterinsurgency, not necessarily the traditional definition of counterinsurgency as I found in my later studies, but search and destroy types of missions. Not much on the advisory effort, primarily focused on, you know, being a platoon leader in the 1st Cav or the 101st or the 173rd. And that was the introductory remarks, the attention grabber in every class. I don't care whether it was leadership, medical subjects, machine gun range, whatever it may be.
Okay. What about weapons training, things like that?
All of the infantry weapons,
mm-hmm.
from mortars down to small arms and pistol, demo,
mm-hmm.
artillery adjustments. Pretty extensive in terms of what a second lieutenant would need to know.
And what kind of, do you remember any specific briefings or classroom lectures regarding Vietnam in the context of, you know, the recent past, especially the military aspects of what's going on in Vietnam, but also the political, social context of what was going on in Vietnam to prepare you?
I frankly don't remember a lot about that any particular instances of that.
Okay.
I got that more when I went to the MATA course at Fort Bragg before mm-hmm. I went to Vietnam sometime later.
Okay. What was the most important thing you took away from the IOBC course at Fort Benning that, you know, later was important for you?
Well, I think the leadership aspects of what you have to do to be a good leader, to get people do the right thing that gets the job done and keeps them from getting killed.
Mm-hmm. Later, when you found yourself in Vietnam, did you feel that IOBC had done an adequate job in its, you know, limited scope of, you know, just trying to prepare you to be a basic infantry platoon leader? Do you think it was adequate to the task of preparing you?
That would be hard for me to evaluate because I went as a captain and I was an advisor. I didn't go as a rifle platoon leader in the 1st Cav.
Mm-hmm.
And I went several years. Well, you know, I actually went in December of 71, so it was mm-hmm. 2 years plus
okay.
after that training that I went to Vietnam.
Okay. How about when you found yourself as a platoon leader in Germany? When you finally did get, you know, here you are, young lieutenant in charge of 30 plus men. Was this a ground infantry rifle platoon?
Mechanized infantry platoon.
Mechanized, okay. Mm-hmm. So you had 113s.
Right.
Was there anything that when you became a platoon leader, was there anything you wish they had talked to you or taught you about?
I think more about the mechanized aspects with regard to maintenance and those kind of things. You don't get a lot of that at Fort Benning, or you didn't in 1969.
Mm-hmm. What was the most challenging part of being a platoon leader in Germany?
At that particular time, the U.S. Army was in desperate trouble in Germany, or all over, I would guess. I had about, maybe a third of the people I was authorized. I had a large number of folks in jail at Mannheim. The Army in Europe was rife with drug problems and race problems, and that's why I volunteered to go to Vietnam. I figured it was safer in Vietnam than Germany.
Safer in Vietnam than Germany?
We probably could not have whipped a determined Girl Scout troop in Europe in 1970, 71. At one point, we didn't have enough money to maintain our vehicles. Half of them we put in the admin storage. Couldn't man the ones we had. The barracks were falling apart. Didn't have parts for the vehicles. It was pretty much a mess.
How did this affect the morale of your platoon and of your unit generally, your company, battalion, brigade?
I think most folks were just in their survival mode. You had some good troops, but the Army did some really stupid things. They sent troops from Vietnam to Germany with less than 6 months to go in the Army. So you can imagine what kind of morale problems and motivation problems they had. There were other localized things that contributed to bad morale. There wasn't a centralized command selection process at that time, so there was a lot of politics involved. I had one battalion commander relieved for racial prejudice, basically as a result of trial by Overseas Weekly. So it was very hard to describe, and luckily the Army will hopefully never go back to those days again.
Can you describe the problem or the incident surrounding this relief, the commander?
At that particular time, the race problems were tremendous. This individual happened to be from Mississippi. I think that was probably the largest aspect involved in his basically being found guilty. I thought the guy was just trying to do a good job, but at that particular time, the Army was bending over backwards to try to put the rods back in the reactor as far as the race problems go. But it was just a bad situation all the way around. This battalion I was in had 4 battalion commanders in 6 months.
4 battalion commanders in 6 months?
Well, we had the guy who was there when I got there. Then he was replaced by a major. Acting, and he was replaced by this other lieutenant colonel who was then relieved. And then we ended up having a guy from brigade, who had been brigade XO, come down to be the battalion commander. The first guy that I got there ended up ultimately being a major general. He was a black officer who was a tremendous guy, but unfortunately I had only a short period of time to serve with him. But the other three guys were pretty much substandard in my estimation. Although the guy who was relieved, it was hard to tell whether he was good or not because he wasn't there long enough.
And what about company commanders and other platoon leaders? Was there a high rate of turnover there?
I'm looking at it from the lieutenant's perspective. We had, about 12 ROTC distinguished military graduates and West Point graduates all show up at the same time, all lieutenants, generally with the same date of rank, all graduated about the same time. And I, you know, looking from my perspective, I thought these guys were pretty decent folks. The company commanders, with one exception, were pretty poor. That's just, you know, looking back and you know, 30 years plus later, but some of the things that I saw them do that, you know, they'd be relieved for today in a heartbeat.
Well, it's interesting the story about the battalion commander who was relieved for race because of the race issue. Because, of course, in the current situation in terms of political correctness in American society and the hyper-reaction that exists in certain institutions and of course, in government and in the military, this is not a new phenomenon. This was... obviously, this was a pretty significant issue for you as a lieutenant and as an officer in the United States Army, and for other officers, that the Army's response to the race issue generally in the United States in the 60s was one of very little tolerance. At least that's what it appears.
Well, it just depends on where you were. There was a very much sensitivity to the situation. And I mean, and it was a very bad situation. Then you add in the drug problems and the crime problems, and we were in a meltdown in U.S. Army Europe in the early 70s. In fact, a schoolmate of mine wrote a pretty good book about the same company I was in a couple of years removed, about that army of that era, and it's I've recommended some of my students, and they just can't believe the kinds of things that went on. In this particular case, I remember one of the incidents was a number of black soldiers stood outside of the brigade headquarters and demanded that the brigade commander come out, you know, bring his honky ass out and talk to them about their problems. In fact, the brigade commander went out there. So that was kind of the atmosphere in which this lieutenant colonel was operating, and I think largely he was guilty of being from Mississippi. I didn't see any overt, you know, racial prejudice on his part. Of course, realizing I'm a white guy looking at that.
But even still, I mean, here, being a product of the military yourself, as the child of an NCO in the active duty United States Army, that's your exposure to different people, different cultures, different perspectives. I mean, if you would have, don't you think you would have been in tune enough to recognize racism if you had witnessed it?
Oh, I would think so. I mean, that's not, you know, I grew up in the Army, so, you know, some of the racial problems that were experienced in the South, I never really overtly experienced them because that's just not the situation I grew up in. You know, it's like my kids, everybody talks about diversity. My kids are Army kids. They've lived in all kinds of communities with all kinds of people, and I think they're better people for it. And so I think that pretty much I felt the same way about me, about myself and my family.
Mm-hmm.
There was a large criminal element involved in these activities in Germany, and it was pretty hard to call out those who, you know, had real racial concerns, and there were real racial concerns about prejudice. But there was also a criminal element there that was just there to cause trouble. And, of course, they were the vocal ones, and they were the ones that got all the media attention, and they were the ones that elicited all the response. I won't tell you that the racial situation in the U.S. Army was good because and I think the Army has dealt with that situation over the years much better than, say, a couple of the other services, one at least, for sure. You know, Admiral Zumwalt talks about some of the racial problems in the Vietnam-era Navy. I think the Army dealt with those kinds of situations much earlier, but it wasn't something that happened overnight.
Mm-hmm. Did you yourself, in growing up in the military, did you ever yourself witness racial intolerance? Discrimination?
Among kids I went to school with?
Amongst kids, amongst adults?
No, not really. You know, I'm, like most kids, I'm oblivious to most of the stuff that's going on around me, but,
right.
You know, that's just the kind of environment that, you know, everyone talks about diversity, but that's the kind of environment that I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Never thought anything about it, neither did my kids.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the criminal element involved in the issues or the race issues and problems in Germany. How many soldiers did you know of that were the byproduct of the you know, being confronted by a judge back in the States who said, you've got two choices. You can either join the military or go to jail.
Yeah.
Were there many of those?
Well, I can only assume they were. And how could I, you know, sit down here and give you the names and the backgrounds of all the guys that I knew when I was a lieutenant or captain? Of course, can't do that.
Oh, no, I'm not looking for that. I mean, can you generalize and say, yes, there were definitely, there were some people like that, there weren't some people like
that?
You have absolutely no idea.
I can make that general statement,
yeah.
But I can't, you know,
yeah,
I can't
I'm not
think
looking
of
for
any specific
yeah.
individuals at the, off the top of my head right now.
Okay.
Realizing, of course, that, you know, I'm reaching my dotage here. So, I mean, it's been 30-plus years since
these
things we're talking about.
Right. Understood. And that applies for all questions from this point forward. In terms of criminal activity, were there any, during your time in Germany, what were the major infractions and how were they dealt with in terms
of... every day. I mean, I had six guys in jail in Mannheim, and they didn't put you in Mannheim for minor infractions.
Do you recall what the infractions were?
Oh, one was for attempted murder. Another one was for assault, beating up cab drivers, beating up other soldiers, assault with a deadly weapon. You know, we had all kinds of incidents there. You know, our scout platoon leader had a new Pontiac Bonneville convertible that was sitting out in front of our company one night. At that particular time, we had thermite grenades on all the safes that were supposed to, you know, in case of attack, we were supposed to pull the pin on the grenades and let them melt the files. And so they were sitting on all the safes. And someone launched one of these grenades out the third floor window and landed on his car and burned its way to the street.
Okay.
It was just a very dangerous situation. One of our platoon leaders and his wife were trying to go to the movie on Ledward Barracks there in Schweinfurt, and a large group of soldiers surrounded his car and began rocking it. And for no apparent reason other than the fact that in that particular case, the lieutenant and his wife were white.
Wow.
It was a pretty bad situation all the way around. We were concerned for, you know, in many cases for our family safety when we were in the field.
Mm-hmm. And how about drugs?
All over the place.
Drugs of choice?
Black tar heroin, if I remember right.
And how was usage in terms of the makeup of your platoon, company, battalion? How would you describe usage in terms of, you know, was it predominantly lower enlisted? Did it infect all ranks?
Lower enlisted primarily.
And how about in terms of either socioeconomic and racial? Were there any racial distinctions in terms of drug use? Did you find, were there more whites that used marijuana or heroin or vice versa?
I think marijuana was pretty much a given. I think the hard users were using heroin. There were, you know, at one particular time we had duty officers in all the five companies in the battalion with lock and loaded 45s.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something you would expect in the U.S. Army in terms of an organization that is built around discipline.
Mm-hmm.
There were places in the barracks that when you went into, you took your life in your own hands.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, my first sergeant kept a metal bunk adapter on under his desk in case he had any trouble with guys coming in the early room.
Were there any was there anybody killed while you were there?
Not in my unit.
Other units?
Yeah.
Other, or, you know, brother units there?
Let's see. I don't think in Schweinfurt. I do remember one incident where it was the 4th Armored Division, which became the 1st Infantry Division forward later, were at Grafenwehr.
Mm-hmm.
And it had an officer NCO softball game on a Sunday afternoon and had gone into one of the mess halls there at Camp Aachen or Normandy or one of the Entombment camps. And we're having coffee and cake, and someone threw two frag grenades in on them. And as I remember, two or four were killed and about 25 wounded.
By your description, it sounds like I asked you earlier what was the most difficult part about being a platoon leader in Germany. It doesn't sound like the mechanized part anymore.
Really, it was just dealing with the U.S. Army circa 1970.
Boy, it sounds like a mess.
It was, and I'm not sure that most folks had a real good idea what the nature of the beast was there. And we were in desperate trouble. You know, the good NCOs were primarily in Vietnam, on their way to Vietnam, or on their way back from Vietnam, and so in large cases, large amount of instances, we had calls for NCOs with brand new officers trying to corral these hooligans, some of whom were fairly well armed. I mean, arms rooms were broken into and machine guns were stolen.
Black market activity?
I would guess. Yeah, I don't know for sure. It was just very shaky situation at that time. We kept all the ammunition on the tracks in the mortar pool, and that included grenades and mines. We kept all the machine guns, the heavy machine guns, on the tracks,
mm-hmm.
not in the arms room.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty shaky.
Was there any black market activity that you were aware of?
Not that I'm overly aware of. I'm sure there was.
Mm-hmm. And how about espionage? Any cases?
No, not that come to mind. I mean, there was the occasional one that you'd see in the Overseas Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like I remember some sergeant in Berlin, but mm-hmm. only vaguely.
And I guess a larger strategy and also to a degree tactical issue. How concerned were you, you know, deep down that, you know, the commies might come running through the Fulda Gap, might, you know, you as an American infantry platoon leader, mechanized, might find yourselves facing, you know, communist Russian armed forces coming through Germany while you were there? Was that a genuine concern for you?
Well, I think it always was. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to realize what kind of upbringing I had. I can remember as being a junior in high school standing at Checkpoint Charlie, looking across the way at some guy looking at me with binoculars, and that made a very large impression on me. The Cold War was very real to me. When you drove through the zone, as my wife and I did when we were lieutenants, when I drove to Berlin, it pretty much looked like those guys had their act together and that they didn't like us, and vice versa, except that we didn't have our act together. That was probably the biggest concern. When we went out on the GDP for an alert, I put little signs out that said machine gunner, grenadier, rifleman, because at one point, I remember, I had 4 tracks and 10 people. I had enough to drive and TC each one of the vehicles, and I had an RTO. And that was my platoon. Now, it doesn't take a military genius to figure out that I wasn't going to be able to helm, you know, the sector that would normally be handled by a 48-person platoon in reality. But the near-term battle, you know, that's always in the back of your head. The near-term battle is trying to get through the next 48 hours, you know, without having some major dust-up with a troop or having somebody throw you out of a window or those kinds of things.
Okay.
It'd be very difficult for me to describe to you the mm-hmm. atmosphere there.
Yeah.
And I don't think Schweinfurt was any different than anywhere else in Germany then.
Well, I think you've done an adequate job at this. It's a very graphic picture and very scary one.
This book, I'm on a portable phone here. If y'all don't have this book in your library there at the Vietnam Center, you should.
Okay, what's that?
The guy's name is Michael Lee Lanning.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got the book back from General McCaffrey that I had loaned it to. So I know it's in my bookcase here, but I don't see it right now. And it was called, like, Armies of Peace. But he was a company commander in the same company that I'd been the XO of later. Right before I left, I was a company XO. And he talks about what it was like when he arrived there. I think it was 1972 or 73. And it's startling, to say the least. But not something that was new to me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the title again? Do you remember?
I'm trying to... Oh, there it is right there. The Battles of Peace.
Battles of Peace.
Michael Lee Lanning. One company commander's battle against drugs and racial conflict in the war to rebuild the post-Vietnam Army. So he got there in 1974. He really wasn't there at the height of the difficulties. But he certainly saw the vestiges of it by the time he'd gotten there.
Okay. What would you consider the most important thing or collection of things you took away from your Germany experience that were important for you later as a as an advisor in Vietnam and later as a an officer in the United States Armed Forces?
I just think the leadership issues about, you know, getting to know your troops and doing the right thing and being fair and equal to all, and trying to preclude those situations that lead to the kinds of unrest that I saw in Germany that probably in the final analysis had some germ of a situation that should have been addressed early on, and it just continued to grow and grow and grow until, you know, by that particular time in the Army that things were way out of control in terms of putting up with drug users, in terms of addressing very, very real racial issues that could have defused a lot of the situation that I saw. And then always in the back of your mind is technical competency, you know, being able to do the things that you're supposed to do, you know, like adjusting artillery fire. If you do that wrong, you kill somebody, maybe yourself. So I think leadership and technical competency were probably the two biggest things.
Okay. Well, you left Germany in, let's see here, this was June of 71.
Right.
Actually, you had three different positions in Germany, platoon leader, battalion maintenance officer, and then company executive officer.
Right.
Was there anything significantly different about your positions as they changed in terms of your perspective, or was it just, you know, again, pretty much dealing with the same issues throughout?
The battalion maintenance officer job was a challenge because I'm not a very technical person. Luckily, I had a very good maintenance sergeant and a very good maintenance warrant who were their business. But it was not a job I was comfortable in. Maintenance was never my long suit. Never was something I really enjoyed.
Okay.
But being a platoon leader and XO, we're pretty closely allied in terms of job requirements.
Okay. Well, you went from there to USAJF KSWC, Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Right.
And this was for the for MAT training, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Military Training Advisors course, which covered all kinds of advisory positions, or everyone went through there, even whether they were going to be an advisor with the Arvin, or they're going to be one of the province teams, or a mobile advisory team, or any other capacity. It was just a general advisor in Vietnam course.
How did you come about this?
It was part of when I went to and volunteered to go to Vietnam. It was part of the, you know, of course, like all infantry guys, I wanted to go to the 1st Cav or the 173rd or one of those sexy line units. And by that particular time, the war, Vietnamization had been initiated, and we had the first troops come home in '69 from the 9th ID from the Delta. So I was told, well, you're going over, you're going to be an advisor because the U.S. units are being withdrawn. So in order to kind of sweeten the pot a little, I think, they said, okay, and I was obviously disappointed that I wasn't going to the 1st Cav. They said, we'll send you to advisor school and we'll send you to language school en route. So I said, okay, whatever.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and discuss as much as you remember your MAT training.
As I remember, it was about 11 or 12 weeks long. It was very intensive. And at that particular course, we got very directive types of instruction on Vietnam culture, history, social kinds of things, how to exist in that particular culture, things to do, things not to do, ideas about counterinsurgency, advisory techniques. It was a pretty professional course. We got a little bit of language training, which was then built on when I went to Fort Bliss to the Defense Language Institute Southwest Branch there at Biggs Field at Fort Bliss. But as I remember, it was number one. It was very professionally done. The JFK Center obviously is pretty much got its act together in that arena. It's what they were about, and they were very, very good at what they were doing. And that training was intensive. Students were motivated because they realized that they were going by the end of the course or by the end of the language school, they'd be in Vietnam, so there wasn't a lot of horsing around. Frankly, more than that, I can't remember off the top of my head. Maybe some of your questions will listen to some more specific responses, but that's generally what I remember.
Okay. Well, let me ask you if you remember anything that was discussed in terms of, well, of course, as an advisor, going over in 71 as an advisor, your key job is part of the Vietnamization of the war. What did you know about that prior to going to the MAT training, and what did you think about that, if you had any thoughts that you recall, about this notion of Vietnamizing the war, turning everything over to the Vietnamese, trying to get that victory with honor that Nixon was so desperately seeking?
You know, as I remember, I don't remember anybody overtly talking about Vietnamization. I remember there was the idea that we were going to train the Vietnamese army, you know, essentially what Vietnamization was. But in terms of the use of that word, I don't remember it. I do remember that the effort was we go to make these guys better so that we can, when we pull our forces out, and there was a, you know, a fairly wide acceptance that now this thing wasn't going to go on forever, that eventually it was going to be over, and eventually U.S. troops, or at least most U.S. troops, would be gone, so the South Vietnamese had to stand on their own. And that was kind of the thrust of it. How do we make them better so that they've got it when we leave? In terms of, did someone stand up and say, this is Vietnamization 101, I'm your principal instructor for the next 4 hours? No, I don't remember that happening.
Okay. What about in terms of training you to coordinate and work effectively with your Vietnamese counterparts? You know, how much cultural training do you recall in terms of, you know, Vietnamese customs, you know, the do's and don'ts, how to get along best, how to be most influential and effective in terms of being an advisor?
There was a lot of the cultural, social kinds of things, things to do, things not to do. There was some on history, but not to the complexity and richness of that I've come to know Vietnamese history in the later years and in my doctoral program, obviously, but much more so than the infantry officer basic course. The focus was kind of on how do you fit in, what do you bring to the situation. The difficulty was it's very hard in that environment to, you know, tell a brand new captain like myself how he's going to be able to insert himself into a Vietnamese unit that's been fighting for years with a regimental or battalion commander who may have been, you know, fighting himself for 25 or 30 years and have any particular kinds of influence. You can't teach that in a classroom. But in terms of setting us up for, you know, the organization, what did it look like, what kinds of operations do they do, the social, cultural kinds of things, I thought they did a pretty good job.
And let's see, did they talk about the types of problems that you should expect to encounter with regard to interacting with Vietnamese
right.
counterparts?
Yeah, they were mostly case study kinds of things, but they at least got you thinking in terms of, you know, what would I do in a like situation like here.
Okay. What based on your training, what did you think would be your primary mission, your primary role, and what would you do as an advisor in Vietnam, based on what they taught you in that training?
I'm not sure I understand your question. I didn't hear all of it.
I'm sorry. I guess what I'm looking for is if there was any difference between what they trained you or what they told you you should expect to do when you got there as an advisor and what you actually did. And so I'm curious, you know, what did they tell you you would be doing as an advisor in Vietnam, and how did that compare to what you actually found yourself doing on the ground in Vietnam?
Well, when I first got to Vietnam, I ended up with an outfit called the Royal Thai Army in Vietnam, which was about a 10,000-man force that the Thais had sent as part of the Free World Military Forces. They were in the process of retrograding back to Thailand, so I was essentially working myself out of a job. I never went on a combat operation with them because they weren't going on any then. And by January, basically, they were loaded up and ready to go back to Thailand, and I was told to go find myself another job because we were all out of a job. So I wandered around a bit and ended up in Swan Lock and got a job with the 18th Arvin Division as a on one of the regimental advisory teams, and that was pretty much like I had been told at Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
The thing at Bearcat with the Thais was kind of an aberration. That was essentially helping them get ready to leave and had very little to do with what I'd done at Bragg.
Did they conduct any operations at Bearcat while you were there?
No. I was there less than 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, they were packing up their stuff and leaving.
Based on that experience, what perception did you have of the Thai Army?
Pretty good, very positive.
Mm-hmm.
I found their officers to be very professional. They had two fire bases there that were still One was called Pratib, and I forget the other one's name off the top of my head. But they were highly organized, well set up. Everything was clean and efficient. I was pretty favorably impressed. Pretty much across the board with the ties.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's see here. Is there any, before we talk more about Vietnam and your specific advisory missions and activities, was there anything else that sticks out in your mind about your MAT training before you left?
Not really. It's all largely a blur because the 900-pound gorilla was the fact that you were going to leave on an airplane, go to Travis, and go to Vietnam. Things were already a little tense in my family because I had volunteered. People wondered if I'd lost my mind. So it was a very tense time. The language training at Fort Bliss was pretty effective. But at 11 weeks, you're just touch. You know, I could talk very well to the other Americans talking Vietnamese. I had a little more difficulty when I was talking to Vietnamese who were talking Vietnamese later.
Okay.
But it was very intensive, and I could see that some of the intel types that went there for a year and basically ate, drank, and slept the Vietnamese language were probably quite proficient because it's total immersion. But total immersion for 11 weeks only gives you a limited amount of capability. Total immersion for a year is a different situation altogether, I would imagine.
The instructors that you had, these were all native speakers from South Vietnam?
Vietnamese women, primarily.
And did they teach you, I would imagine they didn't just teach you language, they taught you Vietnamese culture, etiquette, things like that?
Yeah, in the context of the language, a lot of things that we were talked about were, you know, just normal, everyday living kinds of things that I found to be useful.
Any that stick out in your mind when you finally did find yourself in Vietnam, that, you know, things that they taught you that were extremely helpful?
Oh, I think nothing more than just an idea of how you act in society, you know, not pointing the soles of your feet at people, which they find offensive, and those kinds of things. You know, not any earth-shaking kinds of ideas, but just some common courtesy kind of things that get you off on the right foot.
Okay. And everybody that you were training with in this 11-week course, these were all going to be advisors?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this stage in your career, you're a captain now, right?
I've been a captain. I've been promoted in June.
Okay. So, just as you left Germany?
Right.
Okay.
Weeks before I left.
Mm-hmm. So you're a captain of the United States Army, going through MAT training. As you already described it, things are winding down. And it's just a question of time. You know, at this point in your career, what do you think about what the United States has done in Vietnam? And, what are you and your fellow officers talking about in terms of what we set out to do, what we accomplished, and how we were pulling out?
I don't remember any great, you know, political debates about what we were doing there. Everyone pretty much focused on their lane, which was to go there, do their job, and come home. In terms of what was happening at the presidential level or in Paris or anything like that, I'm sure there was some knowledge of that, at least what was in the media, but I remember the focus being on pretty much watch your own lane. There was a certain idea, at least on some people's part that I talked with, about, you know, if this thing's over, why are we having to go over there kind of thing. But most of the guys I knew were pretty much like me. They were West Point graduates or ROTC, Distinguished Military Graduates, and they were fairly well motivated and had some idea about why they thought they were going.
Was there much competition or conflict, not in a bad way, but just, you know, in a human context, between ROTC graduates and the ring knockers?
No, not overt, I don't think.
Yeah. There wasn't a lot of cliquishness?
In some cases, but you know, you could always see that, but I'd say it was probably the exception rather than the rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else that was important for you before you left to go to Vietnam?
Nothing sticks out of my mind.
Did you feel prepared when you were getting on that aircraft, getting ready to fly over? Did you feel?
Well, I suppose in one sense of my mind I felt prepared, but in the other part of my mind I was wondering if I was prepared enough for what I was getting into.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get a lot of time to sit on an airplane and think about all the uncertainties that will present themselves when you step off the end of the ramp.
Mm-hmm.
When you get there,
mm-hmm.
You're not really, you know, you can watch all the movies, you can talk to all the people you want to, you can read all the books, but you really don't have an idea about what you're going to be confronted with.
Was there much discussion on the trip over? And was it mostly officers being that had gone through training with you to be advisors?
You know, basically you just showed up. Travis got on the airplane, went with whoever was there, or already manifested, so I didn't know anybody on the plane.
Okay.
And as I remember, it was a fairly quiet flight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people were dealing with what they were going to be confronted with when they got to the end of the stairs.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and talk about that. Where did you enter Vietnam? What were your first impressions when they opened the doors?
Of course, landed at Tan Snut, cracked the doors, walked down to the end of the stairway there, and got on a bus that had screen around the windows, which sort of struck me as interesting, because I was smart enough to figure out that was the anti-grenade measure. And then the first thing that strikes you is when they open the doors, the heat is just pervasive. It's like putting on a wet coat. A wet, hot coat. And then there was the usual army bureaucratic stand in line, drag your duffel bag over in this direction kind of thing that went on for hours, it seemed. And then we ended up at a place called Camp Alpha, which was kind of the holding area for those coming or going. We waited for assignments, and that's where I found out that I was going to Bearcat to work with the Thais. They sent somebody up in the Jeep to pick me up, and that's how I ended. That's how I got to Bearcat.
Okay. When was your first interaction with the Vietnamese, and how did that go?
Other than incidental contact, mm-hmm. It was after I got to Swan Lock, the end of January.
Okay. So
mid-January.
During your time with the Royal Thai Army and Bearcat, not many other Vietnamese around there, much interaction there.
Nope. It was a giant base camp that at one time belonged to the 9th, and then I think it had belonged part to the 25th, and we occupied about a third of it, and the rest of it was, looked like a ghost town.
Mm-hmm.
There really weren't, there were, you know, obviously Vietnamese workers there, but I don't remember having any particular contact with them.
What about briefings, in-country briefings, and information that you received when you got to Vietnam? Do you recall anything?
I would say it was probably insignificant because I don't recall any of it.
Okay. Did you, looking back, do you find that to be startling or disappointing?
Looking back, it would appear to me that I understand that when at the various U.S. units had normally some sort of in-country training that lasted from 3 to 5 to 7 days,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know what that involved, but it was certainly kind of an acclimatization process, both in terms of the climate, but as well as the environment, other parts of the environment. I don't remember any of that. I just basically remember getting my orders, getting picked up in the Jeep, and I was off to Bearcat, and that was my introduction.
Okay. For your time at Bearcat, what did you do on a daily basis?
Mostly admin kinds of stuff. We were scurrying around there trying to help them get their equipment together, trying to manifest their troops. We were down to, 25 or 30 advisors, I guess. And basically I was working for a major and did whatever he told me to do. But it was strictly administrative kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. What did you do with your downtime?
Not much. I'm an avid reader, so I always had a rucksack full of books that I'd, pick up here and there. trying to remember. That was about it. I mean, there wasn't a whole got a heck of a lot else to do.
Okay. No, I guess drinking facilities or...
Oh, there was a little club there, as I remember.
Yeah.
Certainly nothing to write home about.
Okay. All right. And let's see. Was there anything significant that you took away from that experience that helped you when you moved on to Swan Lock?
Not overtly. I enjoyed the ties very much and the interaction with them. I enjoyed talking to them and asking them about their country and their military and their history. And I just found them to be very good, nice folks, almost across the board, regardless of rank, regardless of background.
Is there anything else you want to talk about your time at Bearcat?
No, it was pretty fleeting. It was less than 2 months. It wasn't where I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was an infantry officer. I went over there. If I'm going to war, I want a combat infantryman's badge. I wasn't going to get that counting Connex as a Bearcat.
Right. Okay, so you move on in February of 72 to Swan Lock.
January.
Oh, January of 72. Okay, to Swan Lock. 18th Infantry Division, Arvin. And this was Advisory Team 87.
Right.
How were you received there? What was your primary mission, your primary job, and how did you fit in?
Well, there were lots of people moving around in terms of changing assignments because units were standing down, facilities were downsizing. So when I got to the 18th Arvin, the DCAT probably was about 60 or 70 people, as I remember. By the time I left, we were down to about 20. So there was this continually downsizing going on. I started out at a regimental advisory team where there was lieutenant colonel, three captains, and three or four NCOs. And one battalion went out from our regiment. And then at least two of us would go out with a unit. I was first with the 48 Regiment, which was at... Longjaw or Black Horse with 11th ACR had previously been. I ultimately ended up working with all three regiments in the division before I left. Went out on my first operation of about 10 days, went out on the second one, went out on the third one, and the third one I was wounded the first time.
So why don't you describe some of that in terms of going out on missions? And
they were mostly search and clear, search and I think search and destroy is probably too much of an aggressive term to use. Largely it would seem like in most cases to be long walks through the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
Infrequent contact. At that particular point we didn't know at the time the North Vietnamese, and they were North Vietnamese. I never saw a Viet Cong, not in a year. We're laying low in preparation for what was to come with the Easter Offensive and at the end of March and the rest of the year. We had occasionally meeting engagements, and then the first time I was wounded, for some strange reason, we ran into a large regimental-sized ambush out in some areas we'd been working in for quite a while. The only thing that I've surmised in after the fact is that we were getting too close to one of their base camps that they were laying in for the Easter Offensive that caused them to react. Otherwise, they were basically trying to stay out of our way. Normally, we would go out for 5 to 10 days, and I'd say with the regimental headquarters and the battalions would do cloverleaf patrol or large battalion size operations through particular AOs looking for signs of the enemy, and that was pretty much it.
Were these operations in keeping with the tactical principles of counterinsurgency you'd been taught during your MAT training?
Primarily, yeah. They were trying to, they were looking for the North Vietnamese base camps, and essentially what that regiment was trying to do was to keep the North Vietnamese off of Swan Lock, which was the province capital. And trying to keep down any North Vietnamese built up against Swan Lock, and from my perspective, that seemed to work largely, not necessarily because of those operations, but maybe because the North Vietnamese just weren't that interested in Swan Lock. I'm not for sure, not having talked to the North Vietnamese commander there.
And did you have a specific person that you worked consistently with in
No.
the unit in terms of a Vietnamese counterpart?
No. In that particular case, we were a regimental team made up of about, as I said, six or eight folks. And very seldom did the entire regiment go to the field at the same time. So when a battalion went out, it was pretty much who was available at that particular time in terms of an officer and an NCO.
Okay.
And we kind of rotated. You know, if you went out last week, then it wasn't your turn to go out this week kind of thing.
Your other team members, do you recall their names?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Can you tell me who they were? Or?
Well, one of them was Captain Butler.
Mm-hmm.
Our Lieutenant Colonel was a guy named Christie. There was a Sergeant Jones, and there was three or four other folks. There were people continually leaving from the day I got there.
Mm-hmm.
Butler was there after I went to Anlock. It was kind of I ended up away from the division for a large period of time, and that we can eventually get to here, I guess. So I remember a handful of folks there, but not many.
And the rotation system, was it identical to the 365-day rotation system prior to that for conventional forces?
Was in it the terms same? Of what, my tour?
Yeah, well, in terms
yeah.
for advisors.
Yeah,
it was the
yeah.
same tour system.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about that?
Well, you know, in terms of being there, 365 days seemed like a good idea to me. In retrospect, I think the personnel problems and the rotational policies that we set up there were a large part of our difficulties, particularly with regard to six-month command times. You know, one takes 6 months to figure out what you're doing if you're a company commander, and then, boom, you're pulled out and sent to a staff job, and they bring somebody new in. So, you know, the old WAG says we didn't have 12 years of experience in Vietnam. We have a year's experience 12 times. And, you know, that's real easy to say in an academic setting unless you happen to be the guy out there that's going to be there either for 365 days or 12 years.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, you had, this was kind of a new philosophy for the American military. I mean, it wasn't a total war like World War II where, you know, we really depended on people staying where they were, but, I mean, as recently back as that, in terms of from the 70s back to the 40s, we had guys fighting wars for a couple of years.
Duration plus 6 months. I think probably one of the things we learned was that individual replacements is not a good way to fight a war.
Yeah.
That unit rotations make more sense, you know, and that's obviously what we're doing. And in different kinds of conflicts, but in Bosnia and Kosovo and those kinds of things, we send whole units, we don't send individuals.
Right.
And all of the instability that goes with a 12-month individual rotation, we learned all those lessons the hard way, I think.
Okay.
There is no unit cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
You take a unit like the 1st Cav, Hal Moore's battalion that fought in the I Drang.
Mm-hmm.
The comparison between that battalion and that same battalion 4 years later, there's no comparison in terms of effectiveness. Because Moore's battalion had trained together for some of them 2 years before they went, and they remained as a unit, except with the exception of the influx of other persons that they got, other personnel they got before they left to round out the battalion.
In terms of the interaction between your MAT team and the Vietnamese, your Vietnamese, I guess, collective counterparts, how well do you think your MAT team actually got along with the Arvin Army, with the Army Division?
Okay, a little bit of trouble on terminology here. We were not a mobile advisory team, a MAT team.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's a decidedly
gotcha.
Different
yes,
thing
sir.
Than what we were.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. Your advisory team. How well do you think you got along? How well do you think the team got along?
It kind of depended. I thought the regimental commander was, and our regimental senior advisor, Colonel Christie, had a very good relationship. One of the problems that mitigated against any kind of long-term relationship was the fact that we as you've already pointed out, or by your question, is that I wasn't assigned to a particular battalion on a regular basis. So I might go out with the 1st Battalion one time, the 3rd Battalion the next, and that kind of mitigated against any kind of long-term traditional habitual relationship that might foster stronger ties, if you follow my drift.
Yes. Okay. And were there any instances of that you recall of particularly bad communications between the advisory team and the Vietnamese counterparts? And how effective do you think you were in terms of, you know, did the Vietnamese actually listen to your advice?
Well, they, you know, let's be honest about what a captain with less than 6 months in grade, or about 6 months in grade, what kind of advice I've got to offer some regimental commander like Colonel 10 of the 52nd Regiment who'd been fighting for 25 years. Let's be honest. What I had was a U.S. Army name tag that made me the embodiment of the U.S. commitment to support the South Vietnamese. And I had a radio that allowed me to talk to artillery and attack air and attack helicopters. And that's primarily what my function was.
Right. So in reality, it was less advice and more support in terms of artillery support, close air support, helicopter support, coordinating. You were kind of coordinating that relationship between Vietnamese military forces and operations and what little American support still existed in Vietnam.
Yeah, and I can only give you my perspective on it as a brand new captain in that particular situation. In other situations where you had, you know, a lieutenant colonel or captain who was assigned with the same unit for 12 months and went out with them on a daily basis, I'm sure that there was much more opportunity for advice to be given and taken. But that really wasn't my role, given where I was in my career and what was going on there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did did your advisory team talk much about these types of issues? You know, in particular, what your expectations were, your title versus the reality of your position. The fact that even a lot of the senior officers, senior American officers, you know, compared to the Vietnamese counterparts, had pretty slim actual combat experience compared to these guys who have been fighting since, you know, World War II. Some of them probably fighting alongside the Viet Minh, if not with the Viet Minh, against the Japanese, and then against the French at times, and then against each other.
Well, I think, I felt that I was in an advisory role, generally speaking, in terms of advising this guy how we could integrate U.S. support to his plan.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of me walking up to this lieutenant colonel or colonel and saying, hey, I don't like the way you've drawn this route on the map, we really ought to go over here. I mean, let's be honest. I didn't have much to add in that particular arena.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't even commanded a company by that time, much less a battalion or a regiment.
But that's a good point. Your advice was an integration, integrating American fire support into the Vietnamese military operation.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's see here. You do mention that, of course, one of the more memorable experiences, operations you were involved in was the Easter Offensive. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but I'd already been wounded once by then.
Well, let's go ahead and start with that. Why don't you discuss the first major operation where you were involved with the Vietnamese in a combat situation where you're taking fire, your first combat operation?
That actually was the first time I went out. About a 10-day operation. And I remember, one of the things was I got sicker than a dog on the operation. It was primarily, I don't think I was acclimatized to that kind of exertion and that kind of heat. And something that I ate with the Vietnamese, something I ate made me deathly ill. And, I'm just barely keeping up with these guys as they're cutting Vietnamese-sized holes in the jungle. I'm trying to get through them, which is another story in and of itself. And we took some fire. It wasn't anything of great importance, but it was my first time under fire. It's pretty difficult to describe. A little frightening, strangely exhilarating. But once it was over, you kind of felt like, well, I'm glad that's done. Let's move on to the next thing. Because there's a certain amount of I'm not sure how I'm going to react to somebody trying to shoot at me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's pretty much in the mind of any Army officer, I think, until it actually happens to them. So other than that, that was a fairly uneventful
mm-hmm.
operation. The second one, same kind of thing. The third one was the time we ran into the regimental size ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very significant. We had come across a river stream, started up a hill. They opened up with multiple automatic weapons. We tried to move back down the hill, and they dropped mortars behind us. So it was very well set up, textbook Fort Benning ambush. And in the process of that, I was behind a tree firing, and they hit the tree with a RPG-7. And when it detonated, part of it hit me in the leg. And at that particular point, in all of the confusion, the Vietnamese battalion withdrew and left me there with a bunch of walking wounded. Unfortunately, when they did that, they took my radio with them. So for the next 18 hours or so, ultimately we got around the ambush by virtually bouncing until we found the corner and got around it and got away from them. And then we walked this rubber plantation. We walked through the rubber for a number of hours and made it out to a road, spent the night at a Arvin outpost on the road, and then I got picked up the next day. So that was pretty much that. I was less than happy that they went off and left me.
I was just going to say, you know, what did you think and how did you feel about that?
I wasn't too happy. It's kind of interesting. I was ambulatory, obviously, because I was running on adrenaline largely. I just had a big chunk of metal in my knee, so I had a pretty stiff knee, and it cauterized itself, so it wasn't even bleeding bad. But there were some other guys who were hurt worse, and we were kind of dragging them. These were South Vietnamese, and we made it to this outpost, and by that time it was, you know, about 10 o'clock at night, and they didn't want to send a helicopter out to get us because no one was, you know, in danger of dying during the night, so they sent vehicles out, ground vehicles, and picked us up the next day. And then it was just a short jaunt into Swan Lock.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to, I think it was 91st or 93rd Evac. Anyway, it was one of these Quonset Hut hospitals, Evac hospitals, in Long Bend.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember stating, someone from the advisory team came, and I remember stating that that these guys had went off and left me. Well, shortly thereafter, I got word through another captain that my senior advisor had said I was to keep my mouth shut about the incident. And apparently it was one of those kinds of things we don't want to really raise the specter of these guys running off and leaving an American advisor. And interestingly enough, the division commander later got an American Bronze Star for landing in a hot LZ to pick me up, which is kind of interesting, unless he looked like a Vietnamese private in a Jeep. But that's just one of those things.
Had this ever happened to an American advisor in your team or previous teams that you were aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. Been pretty quiet there. Like I say, I think by and large they were laying in for the Easter offensive, so there hadn't been much contact in the recent past in Swan Lock or Black Horse.
Okay.
So it was kind of a political thing, and it was, by and large, we're Vietnamizing these guys, they're going to do better because we say they're doing better kind of thing. So I basically shut my mouth up at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, I had a friend who had been at Bearcat, who was now one of the generals, the deputy three corps commander, his aide. He came to the hospital, and I told him what happened, so I'm sure it got up to the generals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened after that, I don't know. Anyway, I was in the hospital for about a week, and then I was on crutches for about a month.
Now, when you were instructed not to discuss this, did that also mean with your fellow team members?
I think they were primarily talking about outside the team.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk about this with your team members?
Yes.
What was the consensus there?
But you know, by this time we're down to just a few folks, and you know, there were those guys who say, you know, in the confusion of battle, that sort of stuff happens, and there were other guys who had, you know, had their own ideas about the worth of the South Vietnamese, the soldiers, who pretty much said, what do you expect? You know, so it kind of depended on their personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience with the battalions and the regiments was different, depending on the, you know, like all armies, units are different, and largely you take it back to the leadership. So where there was a good battalion commander or a good regimental commander, then the unit was pretty good. Where they were sorry, they were less than pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's no different than in the U.S. Army in many cases. Maybe not to that startling an extent, but there are certainly gradations of ability and capability in all units.
And was there any kind of precautions? Were there any precautions taken, or safety guards or whatever put in place after that incident to make sure that it didn't happen again?
Not that I'm aware of.
Hmm. How about when you're on these types of operations, carrying your own radio?
I did after that.
Okay. So you took your own precautions.
Right.
But not as a part of policy? Or
no.
Okay. And was this ever spoken of again?
No.
Within your team?
No.
Yeah.
I got a cross of gallantry from the South Vietnamese for the operation, which I thought was kind of ironic. But
do you think that was kind of a face-saving measure?
No, not aimed at me, because it wasn't just me. There were about 20 people involved, South Vietnamese as well. So I don't think so. I don't know. And I couldn't. Number one, I couldn't tell what the hell they were talking about when they were making the speeches.
Okay. Well, that brings up another interesting point. You know, when you found yourself actually finally assigned to a Vietnamese unit, how well had the Vietnamese language training prepared you for that, and how did your Vietnamese improve over time? When did you get enough opportunity to practice to get better, but, you know, closer to the time you left?
Well, I mean, you probably studied languages before. In 11 weeks, you can figure out how to order a beer. You know, and a little bit more than that, but that's about all. The problem was that no doubt my language skills improved as I tried to use them, but I think there's a certain reticence on the part of most Americans to try other languages, and I certainly was no different. I could probably understand it better than I can speak it.
Mm-hmm.
Until we got into a situation where both they and I were excited, and then those skills began to fall off drastically.
Okay.
But many of their commanders spoke English anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the communication was primarily, would you say the communication between the advisory team and the Vietnamese was facilitated by their English proficiency,
right,
versus your Vietnamese?
At least in my experience it was.
Okay. And how much contact would you have with the average soldier in this Arvin division?
Oh, when I was out in the field, daily contact. I mean, I moved with the battalion headquarters, and all, and he had his strikers.
And what was your perception and your evaluation of the Vietnamese?
Well, I
armed
think
forces.
I think, like most soldiers, it depended on how they were led.
What did you think of their leaders?
And that varied on who you were talking about. Some, like I say, were very good. Others were not.
Mm-hmm. How would you evaluate when you went on missions and when you went on these operations? How would you evaluate the leadership you encountered there?
Well, it depended on what unit I was with. You know, I worked with all of the units. I worked with all three regiments, and there were all different levels of leadership involved there.
Mm-hmm.
One was extremely good. And consequently, his unit was extremely good.
Do you remember the unit designation for that?
The regimental commander that I remember was the 48th Regimental Commander.
Mm-hmm.
He was very well off financially. He supported out of his pocket a large number of the regimental widows who lived on the base camp. that he supported out of his pocket. He was fluent in English, very cosmopolitan kind of guy, and absolutely fearless.
And how about NCO leadership? What did you think about Vietnamese NCOs that you encountered in a general context?
Let's put it this way. I remember no negative aspects of it. I thought the soldiers, when aptly led, were good soldiers, to include their NCOs.
Okay. Well, were there any other memorable missions that you went on after this, you know, in between that and the Easter Offensive?
Well, basically, I came out of the hospital and I was on crutches, so I assumed the duties as headquarters commandant on the division base camp at Swan Lock, which was where everybody except what was remaining of the advisory team at Black Horse, and they were down to about four guys by then, where all the Americans lived, which was about 45 or 50, I guess, at that time. So since I was on crutches, could not go back to the field, since the headquarters commandant had left, I sort of assumed those duties for about 3 weeks, I guess. Well, I guess it must have been closer to a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I was responsible for all the admin on the base camp, all the facilities, the guards, security, all of those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
discipline and order.
Mm-hmm.
And then right from that experience, I volunteered to go to Anlock and replace some advisors with another regiment who had been overrun and medevaced.
Okay. Now, real quick question about enemy disposition of forces. How well do you feel you were briefed, and how good was the intelligence you were receiving with regard to the enemy forces in the area?
Pretty good around Swan Lock. The 33rd NVA Regiment, we pretty much knew, you know, where they were, generally speaking. It was pretty hard to find them, but I thought the intelligence there was pretty decent.
Did you ever have an experience where you felt that the intelligence wasn't good enough, or you wish you had received better intelligence or a more thorough intelligence briefing, or...?
Yeah, we can get into that when we talk about Anlock, because
okay.
That's a little special situation. And
okay.
Before you want to get into that, this might be a good time to take a break if you want.
Okay. All right, sure. All right, we'll just take... I'm going to leave this, the phone on, but I'll just pause the recording.
So just hang on.
Real quick question about the enemy forces you encountered, your first experiences in Vietnam. What was your evaluation of those PAVN forces?
My only really direct observation of them was during the ambush in February.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And like I said before, it was a textbook ambush, like something out of Building 4 at Fort Benning. Exactly how to do it, very expertly conducted. My impression was they pretty much had their act together.
And how did that contrast with your perception of the Arvin unit you supported?
Like I said, it depended on the unit I was with. In that right. particular case, obviously my experience colored my perception of that particular battalion, but
right.
other battalions I've been out with, it seemed to be quite fairly proficient at what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, if they were well led at the battalion and company level.
Hmm. Okay. What were the weapons that you encountered at Swan Lock from as far that is enemy disposition of forces, enemy weapons?
I'm sorry, say again, please.
What did you find when you were under attack, in particular with that ambush? Was it primarily small weapons? Were there any heavy weapons, mortars?
Mortars,
mm-hmm.
RPGs,
mm-hmm.
Recoilless rifles, 57s, machine guns, RPDs, and the regular small arms, AKs, whatever.
Mm-hmm. How heavy were the casualties that the Arvin unit sustained? Do you recall?
I don't remember that there were any any KIAs, but there were about 20, probably between 15 and 20 in that particular instance, WIAs, of which one of them was me. And I happened to have a young PFC with me who was a signal guy who just wanted to go out on an operation, and he later determined that that was not the operation he really wanted to be on.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't hurt. It was the last operation he went on, though.
Okay. Anything else? I guess the appropriate question would be, what were the most important lessons you learned and the most important things you took away from your experience at OneLock that you took with you, you said, to Unlock, is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Never separate yourself from your radio.
Okay. Anything else?
Nope.
I guess that's a good enough one, too. Okay.
No, actually, the biggest worry there, once we got around, and on any ambush, ultimately you're going to find the edge of it, and we were able to bounce around it without being, they were focusing on the battalion, so we were able to get around the edge of the ambush and essentially get behind them and head to the I knew generally where the outpost was on the road. The way that we were headed, you were going to run into the road sooner or later. I mean, ultimately, if you continued walking, so it wasn't a matter of not knowing where we were. But the biggest concern was that there was a pink team up of Cobras, and they were working their contact, and I did not have any contact with them, and a bunch of Vietnamese, running through the rubber, looks like a bunch of Vietnamese running through the rubber, and you can't really tell which side is which.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid they were going to roll in on us, and they didn't. They didn't see us, because I had no way of contacting them. I had been talking to them earlier. I remember their call sign was Top Hat 10. That's all I remember, and I just knew that this guy was going to roll in on the group I was with, but he was actively engaged elsewhere. So,
okay. All right. Well, I guess what we should talk about next is your transition over to Unlock and the unit that you found yourself working with there, and I guess that leads into the Easter Offensive, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What had happened was we had sent a two-battalion task force from the 52nd Regiment. It essentially was the 52nd Regiment, less one battalion, that had gone up with three advisors to be OPCON to the 5th Arvin Division, which was headquartered at YK. And there apparently was some intelligence that there was going to be some attack, so they had begun to thicken the forces up along the Cambodian border, which the 5th Arvin had the primary responsibility for it, and Lock Ninh. The 52nd ended up setting up in two small fire bases between Lock Ninh and Anlock out in the rubber plantations to the west. And then on the first week in April, the Easter Offensive started on the 31 March at Quang Tri, and then a couple days later they struck at Lock Ninh.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just over the Cambodian, or just over the border from Snoe, Cambodia. And there was a regiment and a couple of other units, armored cavalry troop, all from the 5th Arvin Division that were at Lock Ninh. And essentially that battle lasted about 48 hours. Ultimately, they were overrun. All the Americans were either captured or killed, the exception of one who E&E'd to Anlock. And shortly after taking Lock Ninh, they forced the 52nd off their fire bases, and in the process of moving in contact back to Anlock, basically withdrawn under in contact, the three advisors were wounded, one of them pretty severely, took part of a mortar round in the mouth and was in pretty bad shape. So the U.S. advisors stopped and logged up, and the attempt was made for about 2 days to extract them. Ultimately, they were extracted under heavy fire by a loach.
Mm-hmm.
The first loach that had gone in had been shot down, with both crewmen lost. So I make a long story short, these three guys were pulled out. The remainder of the regiment is back in, or the task force is back in Anlock with no advisors. RO6 says anybody want to go up there and take their place, and so the Cav Squadron advisor and myself, I'd been off of crutches for a few days, said, well, we'll go do it. And so off we went. We took off in a Jeep and drove to Saigon and then up to Lai K, where we caught a helicopter and flew us into Anlock.
Okay.
And that was on the 12th of April.
What were the biggest differences working with the Vietnamese units at Anlock versus OneLock?
Tremendously different situation. I mean, from the next day, the North Vietnamese attacked with tanks and massive amounts of artillery, and from that point, for about the next 4 months, it was more like World War One than anything else. I mean, we were in bunkers; they were attacking almost constantly. 4,000 to 10,000 rounds a day artillery. At one point, we only held about a half a grid square, so it was an entirely different situation than in Swan Lock. I saw unspeakable acts of bravery on the part of some Arvin soldiers. The first tank that was killed by a rough puff, a local guy, who stood out in front of a T-54 and pumped two laws into it till it stopped moving. And by and large, he's standing out there in fatigues, and that's it. Probably one of the bravest things I ever saw.
You mentioned that in the questionnaire, and I did want to ask you more about that. It sounds like quite a phenomenal individual. Can you describe more the circumstances surrounding, how he came upon being in front of a T-54?
What was in Anlock was the Binh Long province capital headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that meant there was a province advisory team there as well. So there was a province chief who at that time was a Marine colonel named Tran Van Nhut, who I actually saw at Texas Tech, not last spring, but spring before last,
mm-hmm.
at the last conference that I went to there,
mm-hmm.
who came out as a general in 75. And now lives in L.A., but he was he's one of the good guys. I mean, he was a tremendous, absolute fearless leader.
Mm-hmm.
And some of his local, regional force, popular folks who were securing that compound that we were in, with their families in the bunker behind them, the tanks attacked into that position, and he stepped out of the bunker and unloaded two laws into the lead tank, which by that time was caught up in barbed wire, which slowed them down, obviously. But from that particular point on, we were under siege until basically June, middle of July, and all that siege warfare entails, complete
mm-hmm.
total, I mean, artillery 24 hours a day,
mm.
repeated attacks almost on a daily basis.
And how much did you find yourself calling in fire support in support of the Arvin division?
Almost daily there for the first month.
Uh-huh. Compared to what happened in Swan Lock, did you even really discuss that? How much fire support did you actively call in at Swan Lock?
Not very often.
Can you describe any of the missions and how effective you thought they were?
Usually it was working pink teams, Cobras, and they were prep fires more than anything else, areas that we were going to go into. Interestingly enough, the first place I was wounded was in an area that had been struck by attack air and was still burning when we moved through it. Shortly thereafter, we encountered the ambush that I already talked to you about.
Okay.
The attack air in Anlock was the reason that it held, that and the fact that when the Arvin were countered, they fought tenaciously because they had no choice. Either fight, die, or give up. There were three choices. That was about it. And the North Vietnamese were not taking too many prisoners, so that narrowed it down to two.
How about the South Vietnamese? Did they take many prisoners?
We weren't in the prisoner-taking business in that particular situation. We did capture a few. We captured a sapper lieutenant.
Mm.
I remember at that particular time we were in pretty bad straits inside the city because the air defense situation was such that we couldn't get airdrops in. We were running out of food and ammo.
Mm-hmm.
And we captured this young lad, and we were trying to figure out where they were getting all this ammo and all the material they were throwing at us. And we just, as an aside, asked him, how are you, what are you subsisting on?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, fruit cocktail, and your Air Force gives us more than we can eat.
Your Air Force? Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Your
the airdrops were falling out. At that particular time, mm-hmm. the position we held was half a grid square.
Okay.
And they were dropping from, had to be over 8,000 feet because the 57 millimeter anti-aircraft guns are good to about 7 grand.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, there were some problems with the chutes, and most of the stuff was falling outside our perimeter and into their area. That latter changed when they brought two riggers in from Okinawa who went out and recovered some of the bundle apparatus and found out what the problem was. But whatever it was, and I'm not a rigger, so I don't know, they went back to Okinawa or went back to Tansanut, worked with the riggers there, and they changed their delivery means, and then we started getting the things that we needed. But for about 3 weeks there, we were virtually out of everything.
Oh, goodness. And so it wasn't a question of whether or not they could drop accurately from 8,000, it's just that for some reason the rigging, as it was being performed, was not adequate to the task.
Well, there were some mechanical difficulties. The air defense umbrella was unbelievable. It looked like 12 o'clock high when anything flew in that direction.
Wow.
57-millimeter anti-aircraft gun is a pretty substantial weapon against high altitude. I mean, you know, 7,000 feet. If you're going to drop stuff accurately, you're going to have to get down there. You're not going to drop it from 20,000 feet. So that in order to drop that stuff, they were bringing them down inside the air defense umbrella. And I had a classmate from A&M who flew C-130s. He said he got back to Tansanut and his plane had 57 holes in it. So essentially what they ended up doing was using ribbon chutes and dropping from a little higher. The ribbon chutes don't have that much drag on them, and they don't drop, you know, directly like a stone, but there's not much drift to them, and that started working then. Interestingly enough, they used the same techniques in Bosnia here a couple of years ago when we first went in there in order to make sure the airdrops were reaching the right people and not the wrong folks.
Okay. What about patrolling? Did the Arvin units do much patrolling? If so, was it daytime, nighttime? I would imagine a lot of contact if they did.
We didn't do a lot of patrolling. By and large, we were in bunkers. We were on a berm line that virtually went around about a half a grid square area. That's where we were pushed into after the first week. There was house-to-house fighting after the initial attack on the 13th, and they basically crunched us down into that smaller area. And then it was primarily something less than about 3,000 guys surrounded by about 30,000 guys, so there wasn't a lot of patrolling.
Okay.
By the way, I think you've got several copies of my monograph there if you want the details of the battle I wrote.
Do we?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I wish I'd known that before the interview.
No, it was my master's thesis at KU, and then the Army published it as a monograph.
Oh, cool.
So if you can't find the copies, give me a call. I got my box full of them behind my desk.
Okay.
And they're all free. You know, Army gives everything away.
That's right. All right. I'll make sure I make a note of that in your file. And so the next time I talk to you, I'll be better prepared for that. Okay. Let's see. Well, what about external ground support? You mentioned the air support you received in terms of resupply, and you mentioned the you're calling in of supporting fires. It sounds like you guys are basically under siege. How about ground units coming in trying to create some kind of relief on the flanks or something?
Well, first of all, there are no U.S. ground units left.
No, I mean, you realize
there's
that.
There's actually one up somewhere around Da Nang or Chulai, somewhere up there from the Americal, and then there's Task Force Gary Owen at Benoit, which was about two battalions. Primarily all they were doing was securing Benoit Air Base.
I mean Vietnamese.
They tried that. They moved the 21st Arvin Division from the Delta and flew it into Lae Cay and then told them to move up the road to open the road, which was QL-13, the highway to Anlot. They never were able to do that, and they took some tremendous casualties because essentially what happened was three divisions attacked Anlot. Anlot, there were at the height about 4,500 folks. Three divisions against 4,500 folks are not very good odds. So in terms of what we were able to do proactively was hold what we had, put in airstrikes, and hope that somebody was going to relieve us from the south. One of those three divisions ended up sitting in positions across QL-13 between Chantan and Anlok, and the ground forces were never able to break through. But in the process of incurring tremendous amounts of casualties, the 21st did tie down that third division. That might have made the difference in the main attack on Anlok. had it been free to join the other two divisions.
Mm-hmm.
So although they didn't open the road, I still think that they were one of the reasons that the city didn't fall, because they kept the combat ratios against Antelope at least workable, given fairly decent flying weather and the fact that TAC Air was stacked up to 30,000 feet on a continual basis.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually General Hollingsworth, who was the senior guy in 3 Corps, everything that would fly and that could carry anything that would blow up, he sent in that direction as fast as he could send it on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So there was Air Force, Marines, Navy, TAC helicopters, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
B-52s, AC-130s from Thailand. Just tremendous amounts of TAC air sorties. And on the 10th of May, there was a B-52 strike every 50 minutes for 24 hours.
Well, how about dealing with casualties? I would imagine, first of all, that given the heavy bombardment and the attacks and things like that on the base, that you had a number of wounded. And how did you deal with them? Were they medevaced? And how did you get new men in? Or did you?
We didn't get much in. My regiment started out before, say, the end of March with about 1,100. We ended up with 400. Casualties, at least in the first couple of weeks, there was nothing going in and out of Antelope. We were able to get some wounded south of town, and there is where we had the infamous Olympic wounded incident, where the stretcher bearers dropped the wounded guys and jumped on the helicopters. That did in fact happen, but I would also tell you, for every guy that did that, there were 5 guys who stayed up and fought until they were either wounded or relieved.
Okay.
But we couldn't get medevacs into the Antelope. Anything that flew anywhere near Antelope was either shot up or shot down. Interestingly enough, the guy that they had last spring, I guess it was last spring, the unknown soldier of Vietnam that they determined was the Lieutenant Blassie from St. Louis, he was shot down at Antelope in an A-37. I remember the day he was shot down. I don't know why he was as unknown, because we saw the plane go in. We knew exactly where it was. We just couldn't get out there.
Okay. Anything else that you want to discuss with regard to your stay there at Antelope?
It was just a fairly significant emotional event. It was very, very close on a number of occasions. There were essentially 3 major thrusts to take the city, and the normal mode was an attack lull, attack cycle, because the North Vietnamese really weren't used to maintaining that level of combined arms warfare. And if they could have kept the pressure on continually, the situation in the end might have been different. But normally they would mount a major attack by elements of 2 divisions. The attack air would enable us to hold it off, and then they would kind of recede for a few days to lick their wounds and put themselves back together. And then they would come back in again. And this cycle went on for virtually the whole time we were up there.
Wow.
But the 3 major attacks were 13 April, 20 April, and 10 May.
Mm-hmm.
And those were all-out, go-for-broke attacks that, in fact, were all 3 broken by air power.
Mm-hmm.
But don't get me wrong. It didn't. All the air power in the world wouldn't have made any difference if the South Vietnamese had nailed their positions.
Right. I mean, the important thing is the coordination and its support.
And that was done by the advisors. I mean, we weren't advising anybody. I didn't have to advise the guy to stay in a bunker. That was pretty self-evident.
Right.
But I did have a radio, and I could talk to the facts, who mm-hmm. controlled all the aircraft in the area.
Mm-hmm.
I could talk to the Spectres directly from the AC-130s.
Mm-hmm. And did they... I'd imagine that was particularly effective.
All the TAC air and the B-52s, the TAC air in all its forms and the B-52s were unbelievably effective, because basically we're talking about when you own half a grid square and you have 3 divisions surrounding you, there's not a it's not a big intelligence challenge to figure out where the guys are. You just dump the ordnance in any direction, and you hit somebody.
Okay. Were there was there anything, any equipment, supplies that you didn't ever receive and wish you had? I mean, you talked about some of the problems with resupply, aerial resupply, but those were corrected. But I mean, actual equipment that you never even really saw, or saw so rarely it was kind of like it wasn't even there.
We had no artillery after about the second night of the main battle, because they were all destroyed. There were only six tubes there, and they were destroyed. So the biggest thing we had were mortars and machine guns. And by and large, what we were doing was holding the guys off on the main attacks while the attack air hit their marshalling and staging areas and hit them as they got up and headed for the wire. So it wasn't too sophisticated. They did drop some strange thing. We got some XM-202s, the four-pod flame rockets. Nobody knew what the hell they were or even how to use them.
Four-pod flame rockets?
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe those a little bit?
Well, they look, have you ever seen a law?
Oh, yes.
Well, they look like if you took four laws and tied them together in a box configuration,
mm-hmm.
And then put a casing around them, that's what they look like.
Hmm.
And what they had was this very strange-looking, like this, a flat base that had four red foil colored projectiles on this base, and you slam the base with these four projectiles in the back of this launcher, and then fired it like a law. But they airdropped them to us. Nobody had ever seen them. They were XM-202s, which means they were experimental at that point. We ended up, the South Vietnamese put them in front of their claymores, which were fairly effective. When the claymores went off, they ignited the flame rockets when they exploded. So that wasn't exactly the way they were supposed to be used. But that was probably the strangest thing that happened.
Mm-hmm. How about other accidents involving weapons and equipment?
The only other thing that we were bombed one night by an A-6 on a sky spot mission, which is basically you punch in the target when you leave the end of the runway. I'm not an aviator, so I don't know all the ins and outs, but generally speaking, you punch in the target on your inertial guidance system or whatever the guidance system you're using for your aircraft, and it goes to that point, drops the bomb, and turns you around and hits you back. In that particular case, the calibration was off, and they ended up bombing inside our perimeter. Luckily, we were all in bunkers, so nobody was hurt.
Mm-hmm. Any other friendly fire incidents, either at one lock or unlock?
No. In that particular case, we were calling the attack air in pretty close, but we didn't have any alternative. It was either bring it in close or they were going to overrun us. So I'm not aware that we bombed our own folks, but realize, of course, we were also in pretty good bunkers. I was in an old Special Forces A-team bunker that had 12-inch concrete walls. Some of the other folks were in less prepared positions, but generally speaking, there was a certain amount of motivation to improve positions as we went along because of the amount of artillery we were taking.
Okay. Anything else you want to discuss about unlock?
Oh, it could go on forever, but you can read the monograph. Probably makes more sense.
Okay.
By and large, I came out with my regiment when it was along about June. We started the end of May. We started being able to. Essentially, the North Vietnamese had culminated. They were still fighting, but they had lost the initiative because the TAC Air and the B-52s had just wrought tremendous amounts of damage on them, and so they were beginning to lose the momentum, and we were beginning to push the perimeter out. And at that particular point, they were able to get some forces in to replace the units that had been attrited down, like mine, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So I came out with that bunch, and then I went back in a couple of weeks later with a fresh regiment. That was the 43rd Regiment, so that was the third regiment out of that division that I had gone with, and they were pretty good. They had pretty good leaders. The situation was had stabilized, but we were still taking artillery. We were still having contacts. And I was there then until the 9th of July when I was wounded the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was dusted off to 3rd Field in Saigon.
Okay. What was your evaluation of the Arvin soldiers in Unalaq?
You know, except for the odd cowardice you saw when people dropped stretchers, they withstood a tremendous amount of hardship. And the bottom line was, when it was all over, they still held the city, and the North Vietnamese didn't.
Okay. In the questionnaire, I asked a question about drug use and American soldiers. What about drug use amongst Vietnamese soldiers that you served with?
I don't have any knowledge on that. To tell you the truth, I never saw it. I didn't experience it. But of course, I didn't live with the South Vietnamese for a year, so based on my limited experience and what I was around them, I didn't see that. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me ask you a strange question here about recreation. You mentioned that you did see Bob Hope in December of 1971.
Right.
And let's see here, Maggie May by Rod Stewart.
Right.
It's the music that you most associated with the war and the Stones. What kind of an effect did seeing a USO show have on you when all this is going on around you, this massive war, South Vietnam trying to fight for its survival?
The only one I ever saw was Bob Hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always been a fan of Bob Hope because I think he's given a lot to this country just by, you know, whether the conflict's right or wrong, he's
mm-hmm.
always there,
mm-hmm.
or he was always there to support the troops, and that's what I appreciated the most. He certainly didn't have to do that. Nobody was making him do it, and I think he's one of the great American heroes for all that he's done for servicemen throughout our most recent history.
Was the Bob Hope show effective in helping lift your morale, lift your spirits, and those of the soldiers around you?
I thought all you really wanted to feel was that somebody really gave a shit whether you were there or not.
Okay.
I don't think, you know, there's this big ongoing controversy about whether troops were spit on when they come home or all that. I don't think that was the issue. The issue was, more often than not, was just indifference. You know, you've just come through probably one of the most significant emotional events in your life, or you will ever experience in your life, and you come home to people who really don't really care. They don't care where you've been. They're not really interested in what you've been doing. And you know, there's a certain amount of that. Okay, so what? And coming out of that particular situation, those kinds of questions probably are more damaging than somebody overtly saying, you know, spitting on you. So maybe the spitting stories are apocryphal. I don't know. I didn't experience that.
Mm-hmm.
I did experience the indifference.
Okay. Well, let's see here. Is there anything else that you want to talk about your in-country experience?
Nothing other, I guess, than the second time I was wounded was much more traumatic than the first.
Okay. How so?
Number one, there were four Americans killed and a Vietnamese killed, all in a matter of nanoseconds.
Mm-hmm.
One was an American general who lived until we got to 3rd Field, and he died on the operating table, but he was essentially, he was dead already. The back of his head was gone. I mean, there was nothing much left of his brain. The other three U.S. officers were killed instantly. And this was the guy in front of him. I could touch both the guys who were killed when I came to. I was basically, my hand was in the shell crater, so why it didn't get me and it got those guys, I never know. Something I wrestled with for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Then I spent 30 days in hospital at 3rd Field, and among other things, I had a busted eardrum and had directional hearing loss, so I couldn't go back to the field. And frankly, I think my bosses figured I was a two-time loser and they didn't want me to be a three-time loser, so. And things had quieted down. I ended up being the division training center advisor for a couple of months, I guess, before I PCS'd. And in that, I actually did some advising because we were setting up training programs, you know, patrolling and range firing and those kinds of things.
Okay.
So that was pretty much it for the 12 months. Fairly eventful.
Yes, sir. When you left, how did you feel? When you're getting on the plane going home?
Well, frankly, I was glad to get out of town. There was a lot of uncertainty by December. You know, I left on December the 2nd or 3rd, and the offensive had kind of shot its wad, and the peace talks were ongoing, and there was lots of discussions about, you know, this is about to be over. And, you know, strangely enough, some people were still coming to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to Camp Alpha, there were guys that were coming into Vietnam, and I was leaving, so, you know, it was kind of mixed signals.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty apparent that, that, frankly, to me, it felt like we had won.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the North Vietnamese had attacked with everything in their inventory, less one division left in Laos, and they had lost. There was no doubt in An Lạc who won and who lost. And three North Vietnamese divisions had been absolutely, almost atomized. And the South Vietnamese were pretty shaky, but they were still in control of the territory.
Mm-hmm.
So I left a certain amount of relief for, I mean, going home.
Mm-hmm.
I had been wounded twice, so there was a certain idea that I was lucky to be getting out in one chunk. And then the other thing was, hey, I think we did a pretty decent job here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe these guys will survive.
Okay. And upon leaving, you know, looking back on your 1 year in Vietnam and looking back at what you had learned, did you have any thoughts at all about the general American effort, the general American strategy, and whether or not you thought in the larger picture, the larger terms, whether or not we were really doing anything effective there?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the Easter Offensive was a battle to the death. I mean, it was clear. There was no nuance involved. It wasn't political posturing. It was pretty much, I'm going to kill you unless you kill me first. And the bottom line is the South Vietnamese, although shaky, were left standing. And at that point, I think that victory, however you define it, was in sight. And unfortunately, we gave it away at Paris. Now, realizing I'm not too objective about that particular assessment. But I've always wondered if, at that particular point, particularly after the Christmas bombings,
mm-hmm.
which come later in December, if we had said, we got a lot more B-52s and a lot more bombs, and if you don't remove your troops in South Vietnam, they're going to be coming again, maybe we could have forced the issue.
Mm-hmm.
As it was tantamount to leaving North Koreans, you know, south of Seoul when we left there.
Mm-hmm.
And said, okay, you're on your own. And that's essentially what we did.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doomed from that point on. And they were, when you add in the fact that we then cut off funding to South Vietnam, and Nixon is leaves office, they are doomed to their ultimate fate at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts in December of 72.
How were you received upon your return to the United States?
Indifference.
Was that in general, both on the military side and the civilian side, or?
The military side was kind of strange. In the military, it was kind of like, okay, that crap's over, let's move on to something else. I actually had an assignments officer tell me, this was in 73, they came out to Fort Ord where I was a company commander in basic training, and they brought all the records and they were doing file evaluations. And I got five OERs in Vietnam and three of them from general officers, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. And so he's thumbing through my file there, and I got three reports as lieutenant. He looks at those and does his whole hum act, and then he takes the next five and he kind of, you know, thumbs them all together and then turns them over in the folder and goes to the next file. And I said, hey, what about those in Vietnam? And the guy said, well, you know, That was Vietnam. You were an advisor. You know, frankly, you'd been better off career-wise if you'd been a company commander in Germany for that period. And I was devastated.
Wow.
And it was sort of like, hey, that bullshit's over. Let's just move on. And it was never really a factor in my military career that I could tell.
Hmm.
There was the idea of, there was a couple ideas offered. Everybody went, so no big deal. Well,
mm-hmm.
everybody didn't go, particularly in my year group.
Right.
And then it was, well, that was an aberration. Let's move on to something else. Now, that's only my experience, and it may be just my experience, but
right.
that's my impression.
Did, as your career progressed, was that perception reinforced?
Pretty much.
Did you ever talk about these types of issues with your fellow officers? Especially the Vietnam veterans?
A few, but there aren't a lot of my peers who went to Vietnam, surprisingly. Probably my class, if you went to Germany in 1969, then you stayed a full tour, that made it 1972, so the war's over.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some of my classmates who went to Fort Bragg for 4 months and went. A lot of those were OBV2 guys, you know, non-RA, and they just got out when they came back. So when you looked around at my peers, many of my peers didn't go to Vietnam. So and if they didn't go, there wasn't anything to talk to them about.
Mm-hmm. What about superiors, you know, your commanding officers?
In terms of what?
The ones that were senior to you, that or officers that you interacted with that were senior to you that did have Vietnam experience. Did you ever discuss these types of issues with them?
No.
It's just, let's just not talk about it anymore.
That was pretty much it.
Well, how did you feel about that?
Well, it was and remains a fairly significant issue in my life, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty high on my personal radar screen, and I never really could understand why what was done or what I did there or what anybody did there wasn't important in the grander scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
I often, before the Great Desert War here and some of the other things we've been involved in,
mm-hmm.
most of my peers had never heard a shot fired in anger.
Yeah.
So their discussions about what you do and don't do in combat were purely academic. It was hard for me to relate to some of those discussions. It's pretty difficult to describe,
mm-hmm.
to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but the whole notion that, you know, here you volunteered to go do what soldiers are supposed to do, and upon your return, you're treated as if, well, not just that your sacrifice, your volunteerism to be involved in the war, that it's irrelevant to your career, and in fact might be even detrimental. Since you didn't get, like they said, the command time in Germany versus
yep,
going over.
I found it a bit strange, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, what did you think about the 73 peace accords?
Thought they sucked. That's relatively crude, but that's about as succinct as I can put it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a window of opportunity there that we did not seize. And it seemed to me that after spending all of that treasure and blood, and not only American blood, but South Vietnamese blood, we basically gave it away in the interest of getting out of there. I've always wondered what would have happened if we had just said, we're not leaving, we're not doing anything until you remove the remnants of those divisions out of South Vietnam. And when I see them go past north of the DMZ, then we'll talk.
Okay.
But there was no effort to do that.
Was this a topic of discussion amongst you and your other another officers that you were associated with at the time?
No.
How things were winding down in Vietnam, the peace?
Not a lot. I have to tell you that not a lot of people talked about Vietnam, either, you know, my peers or my seniors or anybody else. There was sort of the general sense of, hey, let's put this crap behind us and move on.
Okay. And let's see.
I'm sure everybody had their own private thoughts, as I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I watched all this from Fort Ord, where I was commanding basic trainees. The peace accords, and I was there when they fell in April of 75, and the whole thing was just sickening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about family and friends outside the military? Was it pretty much the same thing?
In what way do you mean?
Talking about some of your feelings, some of your experiences, you know, your doubts.
Not something I talk about.
Is it something that you've been able to talk about with your dad now that he's opening up about Korea?
Not a lot.
No. Just out of curiosity, how similar, how close do you find his experiences with the Korean War compared to your experiences with the Vietnam War? Are there any points of commonality?
No, not really.
Yeah. All right, let me go ahead and change CD. This is the end of the first part of the interview with Mr. James Wilbanks. All right, this is CD number two, the interview with Mr. James Wilbanks. Sir, why don't you go ahead and, let's see, tell us what were the most important things you took away from the Vietnam War personally, you know, that helped you as a human being. And also, even though it wasn't something that was necessarily counted as a plus for you as an officer in the ratings system or the promotion system, but what did you take away from your Vietnam experiences that did help you as a professional soldier?
Well, I think probably the main thing is that you know, in the absence of a war, a lot of the things that we do in the military in terms of training, in terms of education, classroom work, all those kinds of things are purely academic exercises. Unless you've experienced them in combat, I mean, you can talk about leadership in combat, you can talk about technical proficiency, you can talk about planning and operations and all that sort of stuff. But unless you've experienced it, it's purely an academic exercise. So what I took away from my Vietnam experience is there's a reason we do these kinds of things that we do in terms of training and education, that there are reasons we do things leadership-wise in order to do the right thing. There are reasons that you pay attention when you're having training and all those kinds of things. That I guess that to make a long, you know, a long discussion short here is that this is a real business that we're in. You need to know what it is that you're doing because it's for keeps when it's for keeps. And I that's probably the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What lessons do you think we should take away from the Vietnam War, excuse me, as a nation? You know, what were the most important? What are the most important things we should be thinking about in terms of our Vietnam War experience as a national experience?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that you have to try to determine when you get involved in those kinds of situations, what's the end game look like? What's the end state supposed to be? How do we know we're finished? And then once you decide that, in terms of a national strategy, you have to figure out what the instruments of power, in terms of military, diplomatic, economic, and what have you, how you're going to use them, hopefully in concert to achieve that end state. In Vietnam, if the end state was a free and independent South Vietnam, certainly the 1st Cav, 173rd, 1st Infantry Division, et al., as a military instrument of power, have a certain amount of play in achieving that end state, but they don't have the only part to play. And I think in our situation in Vietnam, we applied purely a military solution to a much more complex problem. And I don't think we really addressed the roots of some of the ills that that caused our difficulties there in terms of trying to achieve that end state. Once the 1st Cav, 173rd, and those folks arrived on the scene, everything else sort of took a back seat to it. And consequently, I don't think that the instruments of power were used in concert to address the whole situation. And the military instrument was incapable of achieving the overall end state by itself.
Okay. In particular, Do you find these lessons relevant, especially given the types of missions American forces are finding themselves engaged in? Somalia, Bosnia, Kosovo.
Well, absolutely. This is what I teach at the staff college.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about instruments of power and end states. That's national strategy. The thing that's troubling is that we've become involved in some parts of the world with no definitive end state in mind and no idea of how to use the instruments of power in concert. And it's often easier then to just apply the military because they are readily at hand, deployable, and all you have to do is give an order.
And how well received are these types of analyses currently in your teaching environment?
Extremely well received. I mean, most of the students I've got have been involved in Bosnia, Kosovo, Haiti, Panama, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've seen what these more amorphous uses of the military to achieve decidedly ill-defined end states results for the guys on the ground at sea and in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So they clearly understand the importance of trying to decide what does the end game look like.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that, at least from my perspective, the military is not going to achieve the stability in Bosnia over a protracted period of time that's been built on 600 years of unrest.
Mm-hmm.
But it is probably the easiest short-term answer to send the military there.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo, we send the military there.
How receptive are they, are your students, and how receptive do you think the Army is to a more integrated system of dealing with these types of issues in terms of not just addressing the military aspects, but more importantly the political, social, cultural aspects? And do you think the Army has learned enough from Vietnam to do a better job at addressing those particular issues, which are so important in counterinsurgency?
Well, I think the Army has, those are hard-won lessons. I'm not necessarily sure that the political masters have learned that in all cases and in every instance. Like I say, it's very easy to call the chairman and say, you know, deploy the 1st Armored Division to Bosnia. That's easy enough. You can give that order. The issue is often more complex than having the 1st Armored Division go to Bosnia.
Okay.
The 1st Armored Division is ill-equipped to address the social and cultural ills that have plagued that part of the world for the last 400 or 500 years.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that we've done an adequate job of learning the lessons of Vietnam, or are there still things we need to keep looking at and trying to evaluate and integrate?
Depends on who you're talking about.
Politically and militarily, and also socially, because, of course, in a democracy, the military is a representation of the people.
Absolutely.
So
I think the military has learned its lesson. It was a much easier day, or a much easier time during my day in the military because we had a clearly defined enemy, and that was the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. And that's a stabilizing factor, as ironic as that might sound, but at least we knew who we were going to fight. And the end state, if there was a conflict, was fairly clear as well. When you get involved in Haiti and Kosovo and Bosnia and Macedonia, and the list goes on and on, and the potential list goes on and on, maybe it's not so clear. And I think the fact that we have more and more administrations, not necessarily talking about the current one, who have less and less military experience, have more and more tendency to use the military as an expedient means because it's easier to send the military than it is to deal with some of the more thorny issues that take a more in-depth solution, if you will, to address,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
It does, but aren't you talking about the current administration? I mean, the amount of deployments under the Clinton-Gore administration has been phenomenal, and they do turn to the military as a kind of a fix-all solution, and they have.
Well, I'm
talking do you not agree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to talk about the current administration and the numbers of the deployments, but the same situation will face a new administration as well.
Mm-hmm.
It will be determined. What happened is it will be determined upon how they see the situation and how they feel that they have particular opportunities for solution, you know, mm-hmm. what particular arrow they pull out of the quiver. And I would submit to you that the military is the easiest arrow to pull out.
But not always the appropriate arrow.
No, I'd certainly agree with you there.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to talk about ethnic cleansing and stuff, I can certainly stop that with an armored division tomorrow. I cannot stop the inclination to do that with the military,
right.
You know, 6 years from now.
Right.
So it's a real quandary there, and that's what we deal with on a daily basis here. Is given the fact that you might not want to go to Kosovo, that's irrelevant. We have civilian control of the military.
Mm-hmm.
You salute and move out, or you vote with your feet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incumbent upon our students then to figure out how to go and make peace in places like Sudan or other places we might get sent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I deal with on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Given that situation, regardless whether you agree with it or not, how do you make the best situation of it?
Mm-hmm.
And one would hope, at least from a military standpoint, that the civilian masters are looking at all sides of the issue. You know, one of the problems in Vietnam wasn't a problem that could be solved by the first CAF, and that was the corruption in the South Vietnamese government. And until that was addressed by other military instruments of power on the U.S. side in terms of bringing influence to bear, that wasn't going to change. It didn't make any difference how many North Vietnamese the first CAF killed. But part of the, I think at least in my mind, part of the problem with that and the way the military was used there lies with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And at some particular point, the military leadership has to stand up and say, you know, given your end state, here's the X percent of the solution I can provide. I cannot address the other remainder. And I don't think that was done in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's being done now? And what is, you know, basically we're talking about the development of the national strategic level of having a goal, a way of defining victory towards that goal, and a way of defining when you achieve the goal. And, you know, one of the big debates about current deployments is, especially to places like Bosnia and Kosovo, Serbia, do we actually have those in place? Do we know what we're trying to, do we generally know what we're trying to accomplish? What national security interests are involved? And how do we know when the end game's going to be there?
Sure, that's a big problem. I mean, in the short term, you want me to separate the warring factions and institute a zone of separation, I can do that. Now, do I have to do it for the next 300 years? Or is there something else involved here?
Mm-hmm.
The best thing the military can do is to set the preconditions for the success of the other instruments,
mm-hmm.
Whether they be diplomatic, economic, informational, or whatever. But more often than not, it ends up being the answer to a question that it can't answer.
What about some of the other more other complex issues involved here? And there, I think, are some interesting correlations and issues between Vietnam and some current deployments. In particular, of course, recently there have been some allegations of some rather troubling behavior on the part of Americans, and in particular members of the 82nd Airborne Division in Kosovo.
Right.
You know, not whole scale slaughter and murder, but you know, one of the problems with leading men in foreign countries and combat and high stress situations is, you know, there are going to be problems and conflicts and potential atrocities. Do you think that in at least in your environment, in your teaching environment, are you guys discussing these issues as well?
Absolutely, every day.
You know, My Lai and the Vietnam experience and
not so much things like as overt as My Lai, but mm-hmm. the kinds of things that are going on in Kosovo and Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the big problems is if you take the military out of the aspect of doing the things that it is trained to do, which it at its essence, as troubling as it might seem to a large part of American society, it's close with and kill the enemy. That's what it traditionally has been. That's why we have an army, in most cases in our history. The problem is, if you train guys to do that, then you put them in something less than that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers don't have an on and off switch.
Right.
So if you get, and I got an email from one of my friends, or one of my students from last year, who's a lawyer in Bosnia right now, who was out conducting his business in one of the communities there, and got involved in the wrong end of a rock throwing contest, where pieces of concrete were being thrown at the American soldiers. You know, if you got these young lads and lasses out there and you're teaching them to be aggressive soldiers, if you don't have a very disciplined unit and you get involved in those kinds of situations, there's an opportunity for some abuses there. And I think that was the case in the 82nd, and what they're going to find out when they look at that unit is that it lacked discipline and that the leadership was faulty. And in that particular case, that on-off switch comes to play fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no doubt in my mind that there's a problem in that unit, and that it needs to be nipped in the bud fairly quickly. But the difficulty is, you take guys out here on the tank range, and you run them down range and tell them to kill everything in sight, and then you take them over here and say, okay, now I want you to be a peacekeeper and win the hearts and minds. It's a little difficult translation sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if there is a threatening environment and a force protection issue there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not so hard to get off the boat as the Marines did, coming back from Desert Storm, and going to a place like Bangladesh on Operation Sea Angel to relieve suffering in a non-threatening environment where they don't even have to take weapons ashore,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to take them and dump them in the middle of Kosovo and say, okay, make peace, and demonstrate that we're having regional stability here. So those are two different kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the same set of troops.
So how do we address this as a nation?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. We try to deal with it on a regular basis. The best thing the military can do is try to make the best of the situation that they're plopped down in, because
mm-hmm.
ultimately the decisions are made by the civilian decision makers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're put into a peacekeeping situation, how do you do that? So, one, you try to achieve your part of the end state, and two, you try to protect the force at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Man, those are mutually dichotomous in some situations.
Right.
By and large, whether you want to go to Kosovo or not, you can either go or you can take your uniform off.
Right.
Those are the decisions that you get to make.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the situation that we're going to deal with. There is no, you know, short of the Chinese coming up with some power projection capability in the next 5 years, we don't have an immediate threat from a peer opponent.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, the things we're going to be involved in are the things that our civilian masters tell us we're going to be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And that runs the gamut from fighting forest fires to separating warring factions to passing out wheat
mm-hmm.
in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't determine what the end state looks like, then you end up with something that looked like Somalia. And halfway through that mission, having fed X million Somalis, we should have declared victory and went home, and everything would have been fine. But we hung around for a few more months. Then the mission changed, but the force structure didn't change. And we went from passing out wheat to trying to find Farah Aidid, and ultimately we lost a bunch of Rangers and in some fairly intense contact there that they were unequipped to deal with.
Well, see, as an historian, I know you will identify with this question. This isn't new, though. I mean, in terms of American deployments of the 20th century and the late 19th and the rest of the 20th century, there's been a tremendous amount of activity. Excuse me. With regard to politicians sending American forces out to create stability in various regions of the world, in particular, especially in our backyard, the various Marine deployments in the first 20, 30 years of the 20th century, the notion that the military forces are used to suit the political means or ends of a particular administration. This has been an ongoing situation, especially since we became a global power at the turn of the century. And so I guess I'm curious, do you think that there are valuable lessons that we should be looking at? And since you're an instructor there at the college there, at the school there, is there, should we be looking at those types of issues as well, those types of experiences to try to draw appropriate lessons and conclusions on how the military should be effectively dealing with the situation?
Well, we use case studies all the time for doing that. I don't think the tension is necessarily for the military to figure out how to do these kinds of things. As you say, we've been doing, military operations other than war since the beginning of our history, starting with the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yes.
I don't think that's necessarily the biggest problem, although there's a certain amount of emphasis on tactics, techniques, and procedures for, how do you institute a zone of separation between warring factions in the former Republic of Yugoslavia. Well, that's decidedly different than taking a tank down Tank Table 8 at the National Training Center. But we do have a body of knowledge that says how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The real tension here becomes when you have civilian decision makers who don't really understand capabilities and limitations of the military that apply that military force to achieve an end state that they cannot achieve.
Mm-hmm.
The misapplication of power. We have all the power in the world. We can do virtually anything you want to, although that capability is decreasing on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the force drawdown and what have you. Our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are meeting themselves coming and going. And that's why we're hemorrhaging people out of the service now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because they don't like the job. Most of these people are highly motivated. It's the fact that the young Lance Corporal gets tired of being gone all the time. We've got kids on the West Coast who come in from a deployment, spend 2 weeks, and they're back out for another 6 months. Now, who wants to live like that? Particularly if you can't make a good case for that deployment in that young kid's mind. There's nothing that a young soldier or airman or Marine or sailor likes than to be doing something real that they can see. If you talk to any of those kids who came out of that Sea Angel thing, when they came back from helping the Bangladeshi people, they felt like they had done something real and something useful. But when you send them on these deployments that seem to have no end in sight, that don't contribute toward any kind of end state, it's a pretty hard sell.
That sounds an awful lot like Vietnam, to a point.
Well, it certainly does. And you asked a question earlier about what the senior officers are doing. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not privy to those kinds of conversations.
Yeah. Okay.
I do know that watching C-SPAN 2,
mm-hmm.
the only service that almost continually points out the problems is the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And General Krulak, until he retired this summer, mm-hmm. as the Commandant of the Marine Corps, was very vocal in pointing out those things that, number one, are his responsibility under U.S. code, in terms of providing military expertise and his particular service to the civilian decision makers, and he gets lambasted in the media for being disloyal. There's a problem there somewhere. Do you want the truth or do you want loyalty? So I don't know the answer to that. We try to deal with that on a daily basis, and I'm not, we talk about these issues in the generic sense. We certainly do not enter into specifics or personalities in the classroom, but it's the kind of things these folks are going to have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are the leaders of tomorrow. There will be 10 or 15 general officers out of this class
mm-hmm.
in 10 years. That's traditionally the way it goes.
Okay.
At some particular point, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs sat in this classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So as young majors at about their 12th or 13th year of service, they need to start thinking about these kinds of things, because prior to that time, they're pretty much where I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
They were down at the bottom of the food chain reacting
mm-hmm.
and not really considering about the strategic, political, military scenarios being involved. They were the executors. Well, this is kind of the break point in their careers where they become part of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important we talk about these kinds of things.
Yes, sir. What about the, closer to home in our backyard, the narco-terrorist issue, narco-terrorism, in particular the current American support most of it not public in terms of the American forces that are down there and advisors and things like that. Some of it is, but the amount of support that we're providing the Colombians in particular, is the American role in support of those types of operations discussed much there?
Well, I think there's an appropriate mission for a certain part of our military.
Mm-hmm.
I think the larger question is how do you attack the war on drugs? Is it truly a war or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you cannot target the demand, the supply is part of the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the military can do with regard to the question of demand.
Mm-hmm.
And what we can and can't do, obviously, at least within the confines of the United States, is limited by posse comitatus, as it should be.
Yes.
But by and large, I mean, you can make all the great drug busts in the world you want to, but as long as people want it, it's still going to get through one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
particularly as long as it's economically lucrative as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of training other forces in order for their own internal security, that's the kinds of things that we've always done. That's the kinds of things I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the talk about Colombia, the next Vietnam, is almost laughable. We're talking about two different things.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of people in the media who throw Vietnam around without much knowledge or judgment involved when they do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of media, what did you think about the role of the media in the Vietnam War? And do you think that the National Command Authority has adequately addressed the problems that existed, or do you think that there were problems in Vietnam with the media? I mean, do you think that's all hype?
No, I think there were problems. There's a very good book by a guy named Peter Braestrup,
mm-hmm.
Called The Big Story.
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with it, but
yes.
A TV guy,
mm-hmm.
Of the TV community there, who basically took his peers to task and himself to task for the reporting on the Tet Offensive. I will also say that while I find some of the things the media did there not too positive, that the military is partly responsible for failing to be candid with the media in the first place. And drawing some pictures of positive progress and positive action, we overstated our case and in some cases lied. And I think once you've done that, you've co-opted yourself, and the media responded accordingly. So I think there was more than enough blame on both sides to go around. But I think the media should be held responsible. The Tet Offensive is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
Very splashy, the first week or so of the offensive, are reported in a sensational manner, which in fact it was a sensational event. But there is no, Paul Harvey, the rest of the story. And ultimately, the Tet Offensive was a great defeat, and the Viet Cong ceased to exist as a military, a significant military entity after the 68 Tet Offensive. But that part of the story is never given, was never given in 1968. And it's almost, hey, these guys lied to us, it's really worse than it is, and so now we're going to show that it's worse than it is. And when there's an opportunity to go back and correct the story, the corrections aren't made. And in fact, in every case after the initial attack, the Viet Cong are defeated and are virtually decimated. That story doesn't come out. What comes out is the 18 guys trying to get in the U.S. Embassy. Or the Marines battling to get back into the Citadel at the Way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kinds of things you see. Or Dan Rather walking around the same burning C-130 for 5 days. Making it look like the runway at the caisson is inundated by burning C-130s when in fact there was only one.
I think
we learned some lessons there. The long,
mm-hmm.
long amount of dribble there to get to the
no.
bottom line, I think.
No.
Is that we have learned some lessons, and one is that you don't try to bullshit the press.
Mm-hmm.
And I know during Desert Storm there was an effort to educate the press on when you go out here and see this happening. And in fact, there were instructors sent from Leavenworth up to Washington who met with the press pool and said, okay, here's the kinds of tactics that you're going to see. Here are the vehicles. Here's the kinds of organizations, trying to give them an idea. You know, and there were, God knows how many accredited journalists involved in this process, virtually none of whom had any experience with what they were looking at. So there was an idea, okay, let's be straight. Let's educate them what they're going to see. And then, you know, the press pool bothers a lot of people, but even at that, I think there were some abuses on the part of the press, you know, and then there, it's some egregious bitching and moaning afterwards as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy was told to conduct feints and demonstrations out in the Persian Gulf that would give the idea that there might be an amphibious operation against the Kuwaiti coast. Does the American media, do they exercise any self-discipline and not report it? Hell no, it's flashed all over the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the fact, there is a whole bunch of puling and whining about, we were used. No one used you. We gave you a window of opportunity, and you moved to your own music, which was to report it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have your cake and eat it, too, to mix several metaphors here. So, like I say, I think there's two ends, two sides of this particular coin, and considerations on both sides. I believe in a free and independent media, but I also believe in a self-disciplined media, and I'm not sure that we've got that in all cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, regarding the role of the media in Vietnam and some of the questionable reports that were provided to the media by the military high command, what did you think about the 5 o'clock follies, the emphasis on body counts, statistics, quantification, but especially the body count as a measure, a gauge of, you know, were we winning? Were we successful?
Well, the bottom line is that what we had was a strategy of tactics, and that tactics was attrition. And attrition doesn't work unless you can kill more of them than they can produce, and we never were prepared. If you're going to do that, that means that's total war, and you go all out to destroy as many of them as they can, to bring them to whatever position you want them to be in. The problem with fighting an attrition war in Vietnam is North Vietnam was fighting a total war, and we were fighting a limited war. Consequently, we never win, and they win as long as they avoid losing. So the strategy of the attrition was bankrupt from the beginning. And attrition meant nothing if you couldn't have a strong and independent South Vietnamese government that could win the support of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Attrition had absolutely nothing to do with that. But it is easier to count bodies than it is to count support,
mm-hmm.
or credibility or those other more amorphous ideas.
Right.
So if you've got bean counters who are in charge of the Defense Department, they want to count beans.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular count, that particular instance, body is equal to beans.
How about the allegations that body count figures were inflated?
Oh, I'm sure they were. Little doubt in my mind that they were.
Did you witness anything like that while you're in Vietnam, when reports were handed up from the Vietnamese forces to their higher headquarters?
No. I really, frankly, was not in that kind of business.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm sure the division staff was providing figures upwards to the three-corps staff, but, you know, I was at the bottom of the food chain. I didn't see any of that.
Okay. How do you feel today about your Vietnam service?
No, I'm very proud of it. It was a seminal event in my professional life.
Mm-hmm.
It basically colors everything that I am and everything that I think. And it's always there.
Is there anything else you'd like to discuss today?
Not necessarily. I mean, nothing that comes to mind now. I'd certainly be willing to talk to you later if you have some other questions that you want to follow up on.
Okay.
Once again, these are only my opinions and my perceptions.
Yes, sir.
Right or wrong.
Understood.
They're the only ones I got.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Certainly appreciate you sharing this with me. Let me
no
go ahead and
if you've got
end
any,
this.
Any follow-up or anything, feel free to give me a call and we'll set up another time.
Yes, sir. Would you stand by a moment?
Sure.
I just want to end this officially. This ends the interview with Mr. James Wilbanks.